because the heading for the MTBBS period, and at the same time, before we do that, we need to evaluate the performance for the past financial year, how have we performed. We are expecting the department to present before the Portfolio Committee the annual report for 2009-2010. And we do trust that at least we will receive a report that is where there is an improvement from the previous years, 2008-2009. And I think we, in actual sense, one would say that there has been an improvement in our observation, but I don't know, we'll see if you are getting better, we have taken a step back forward. Today, we were supposed to have a presentation from the National Department, but they have apologized because of their meeting. So we will have them at 2 p.m. We are going to get a presentation from HDE now. Then after HDE, it's going to be NHSC, and then NETA. So we're going to take those three entities for now. So I wish to hand over to the department the presentation of HDE. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, for giving us this opportunity to brief the Portfolio Committee on the performance of housing entities. The CEOs of the entities are here. They will lead the presentation. Having said that, I'll hand over to Mr. Taffy Adler, who is the CEO of HDA. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and others who are here, including our friends from the department, for that introduction. Based on your comments, Madam Chair, luckily we don't have anything to prove because you've got no comparison for last year. This is probably the last time I'll be able to say this is the first time I'm doing something in front of this committee, because each time I've been able to say that, but I think going forward that's not going to be possible.
Because really some of you don't know the members. Well, it's a long time that we even the entity. I don't think you have met the members from 2009-2010. I don't think so. Let's just make a quick introduction so that we know each other.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Doria Bowman, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Morning, everybody. My name is Butch Stein.
Morning, Doris Labota.
Morning, everybody. My name is Archibald Figlin.
Morning, my name is Kepa Mabad, remember?
Makosa Zanan Jobi.
Mel Covenant, DMG.
Morris Ngomizulu, National Department of Human Settlements.
Good morning, all. Morgan Pillay, Managing Director, Nurture.
Viwe Gweta, Director, Operations, Nurture.
My name is Sindisa Musani, Financial Director, Nature.
Hi, I'm Kate Chan from the HDA.
HDA.
Good morning. I am Joseph Malikutuli Shabani from the HDA.
Morning. I'm Sanamuna, the CFO, HDA.
Good
morning, Odette Crofton, General Manager of Projects and Programs from the HDA.
Morning, I'm Leah Potsoahi, a researcher in the Popolo Committee of Human Settlement.
My name is Mpoka Sabone. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee.
It means NHSC is not here. I want to correct that. It means after HDE, we're going to receive a presentation from NETA.
Chairperson, they have indicated that they will be here before NETA is able to... Yes, they are on their way. In fact, they've spoken to me. I can assure you that they'll be here. The sequence, it doesn't matter. Yes, thanks.
Thank you, Chair. And just to reinforce the introductions, clearly what we've got here are our senior management team, the EXCO, the people in the front, and Kate Chan behind us is our newly appointed communications officer. So we now have that capacity in place. Hopefully you'll see more of the HDA in public as a result of that appointment. Madam Chair and committee members, what we're discussing obviously is the last year's performance, and what you should have had a chance to look at, and what I'm going to take you through, is clearly the printed annual report, and we would see this as the sort of publication of that. And you would have had a slide presentation which had been distributed. I am going to take you through on the screen not the slide presentation in its wording. I'm just going to take you through the pictures, and hopefully you will give a verdict on whether this works or not. And essentially what I'm trying to do within that is establish the HDA's footprint in a visual manner over the year that we've been operating. So you will be able to follow on the slide presentation. The pictures follow each of the slides, but not entirely that way. The first part of the footprint, Chair and committee members, is our legislative mandate. And that obviously comprises the mandate we get from our various pieces of supporting legislation, the Constitution, the Housing Act, the Comprehensive Plan for Development of Sustainable Settlements, and the Housing Development Agency Act. And that's the first base on which we would work off. Just noting that arising from that constitutional obligation, there are two areas which are not yet fulfilled. The first is the conclusion of the written mandate, which we're required to do in terms of our Act, and the second are the regulations, which again are requirements in terms of our Act. The HDA mandate has been discussed between us, the provinces, and the National Minister. It's obviously had to go through some changes as a result of the delivery agreements. So there's been some toing and froing about that. We are, as a result of all those interactions, in the final stages of the wording of that document, and I am fairly sure that the mandate will be completed in the near future. As regards the regulations of the agency, there are two elements to that. The first are the normal regulations governing our way of operating. The second are regulations that we are required to do in terms of the priority housing development clause in our Act. We made, I think, the mistaken calculation that we'd be able to do both simultaneously. So although the normal regulations were completed some time ago, we asked to hold those back until we completed the PHDA regulations. That turned out to be a fairly complex activity, because essentially what we're trying to create is a situation where if we declare with the Minister a priority housing development area, there are certain regulations, there are certain benefits, there are certain first leg of the operation, or our map, if you like, is the legislative mandate, and those are the 2 points that I wanted to make out of that. The second leg, if you like, of our map are our objects, and those are listed in the presentation as to identify the land, to project manage, to ensure and monitor that there's coordinated planning and budgeting of infrastructure, and to monitor the provision of all infrastructure required for housing development. Again, those are proceeding, and we'll deal with them a little more in the rest of the presentation. But I want to note 3 points here. The first is that two of those requirements, two of those objects, are actually very difficult to perform for an agency like the HDA. The first is to get centrally coordinated planning and budgeting of all infrastructure. We would like to be in that position. But until we merge with National Treasury, that's not going to happen. So just to note that that's a difficult thing to do in the first instance, and also to monitor the provisional infrastructure required for housing development. That is currently spread across a whole range of departments who deal with municipal infrastructure. COPTRA is involved, the various municipalities involved. So again, it's a very difficult objective to realize. The one objective that is not here, not noted particularly, but which is an important part of our work, and it's contained in Clause 7.2 of the Act, is around the requirement that we create a national inventory of land. And that actually is proceeding quite well, as I will talk to in a little bit later. The third part of our map, if you like, is the whole governance area. And there one deals with the board, the subcommittees, the policies and procedures, and the statutory compliance. And that's actually working exceptionally well. The board is active, supportive, meets regularly, has adopted all the various policies, has been supportive in the work that we've done. The subcommittees are up and running, and in particular, the finance and the audit committees, the HR committees. All the policies and procedures that we're required to do have been adopted, and as you would have seen from the auditor's report, we've got a clean report on statutory compliance, and all of that has worked quite well. Interestingly enough, on the auditor's report, as you would imagine, there was an item of note, I believe it's called, and that's because we saved money. We got involved in a renegotiation of the leases of some photocopiers, which were taken over from Tubidish in this case. We renegotiated those to a cheaper price, but we did it on the basis of a 5-year instead of a 3-year lease. And in the period, the classification of those moved from ordinary leases to financial leases. So we were found to be out of compliance with the requirement that you'd have leases for less than 3 years, or you shouldn't have leases for more than 3 years. We've rectified all of that, but that's the only comment that was made on our statutory compliance. So all of that is working and is in place. And then finally, and that starts to give us our map of South Africa, relates to the organization. And again, that is growing nicely from our point of view. The systems and the processes are in place. The staffing is in place. The skills are in place. We are in our second phase of strategic planning. And there is a program of financial reporting, and we've generally been in compliance with all of those. So from all of those points of view, the organization is working quite well. We then move to give some body to the work that we've done. And the first area, which really would be the roadmap, is in our goals. And those you can see kind of spreading across the country, and there are four goals which are listed on slide 6 of your presentation: land, property, availability and release, land and property holding, human settlements, planning and preparation, and organizational credibility, i.e. do we trust the HDA to do what it's supposed to do? All of those will start to be explained as we go through the rest of the presentation. In terms of our presence, we now have, and you can see them on the map, three offices.
head office is in Johannesburg currently. We have an office in PE and an office in Cape Town. Those essentially come out of the two biggest projects that we inherited, the M2 Gateway and the Nambula project in Nelson Mandela. There is increasing need, if you like, demand for alternative offices. We are very busy in KZN at this point in time. We are quite busy in the Northern Cape. And as demand emerges to justify the establishment of an overhead as an office, we will get there. But we do have those three offices and approximately 74 staff members in place around the country at this point in time. We now have relationships with six metropolitan municipalities, direct relationships with them, and that's noted in the yellow. Those are the areas that we're working hardest in at this point in time. And we also now have set up relationships with a number of provinces, and again on the map you will see the indication of where we're working. In most of those cases there is a formal document that has been presented. In some of those cases that implementation protocol, which is the tool that we use, some of those cases those implementation protocols have been signed, in some they haven't, but in general we're working with most provinces, more intensely with some than others. There's very good take-up in Limpopo. I'm going from the top to the bottom to not give preference to anybody, but there's very good take-up in Limpopo, there's good take-up in KZN, there's good take-up in Eastern and the Western Cape, and for the balance, we're still in negotiations. There is mention, and there has been for some time, discussion about the Servcon properties, and that was going to be the kind of first major land acquisition into the HDA, and again, you'll see where those are situated around the country. The Servcon transfer has not yet taken place. That has to do with internal concerns between the department, or from Treasury to the department, around the closure of Servcon. So while the HDA has put in place the capacity to manage those properties, we've assessed all those properties, we know where they are, we know in what condition they are. The final transfer is pending a discussion between Servcon, the department, and National Treasury. There's also been quite a lot of discussion about land in the Western Cape, and just to note that that's been part of the discussion around the N2 and Phase 2 of the N2, and I'll make mention of that going forward. In general, and this is through our Lapsus GIS-based system, we have identified almost 1 million hectares of state land. And we also have had offers of almost 1,300 hectares of private land. We've been unable to take those offers any further because of, again, an issue that the committee is well aware of, which is the capitalization of the HDA, and I'll mention that going forward. Perhaps, Chair, if you'll permit me, I'll just take you beyond the annual report so that the committee does know that we're moving into the second year. And that is to say that in this past quarter, so momentum is starting to build. There's been a transfer of 72 hectares in Bela Bela, land that we have purchased on behalf of the provincial authority there, 105 hectares in the Free State in 8 parcels of land, and there's been an application for properties measuring 28,000 approximately hectares from the various national departments who are the custodians of those, and that's in pursuit of the obligations of Outcome 8. So there has been quite a lot of movement around property development, and I hope by this time next year we will be able to support report significant progress in that area. Then if I can talk to the projects that we are currently involved in. So I've now moved to slide 9 on your presentation, and you will see where they are situated. Moving from the south of the country on the N2 Gateway, we think we've done quite a good job in supporting the turnaround of that project. It now is certainly, and I think everybody who's associated would agree, that there's now an operating governance framework, an operating steering committee, which has all of the stakeholders, national, provincial, and local government, actively involved in discussing it. There's a business plan, there's a project management and a management plan, and there's currently discussion about the second phase of that. So while delivery is only now starting to pick up, and it's taken us a year to get to that point, I think that most people involved in the project would confirm that it is now a much more stable project than it has been in the past. Similarly for Zanambula in Nelson Mandela, there has been good progress on that side. There are now new projects, post-Tbilisi projects, if we can call them that, which are in place. I guess how many units in the new chat is? How many units are we talking about? So contracts have recently been signed for over 1,300 units. There remains a legacy problem around the payment of contractors in the previous project and the older projects. Again, that has to do with the closing down of Tbilisi's operations and the ability to cede across some of the contracts that are involved there. And that remains a major issue. Kunubia is the project that is kind of moving higher and higher up the radar. It's a huge project. It's 1,200 hectares of land. It could be as much as 50,000 residential units plus commercial and industrial activity, and it's going to become a major project over time under the control of the city with the support of the province and obviously national. Bela Bela I've mentioned, there we have actually signed all the agreements which take control of a piece of land which will be immediately adjacent to the existing area. And over the next 12 to 18 months, we should be able to see significant development in that area. Germiston is a project where we're supporting the regeneration through the council of the inner city of Germiston. Germiston is what the council wishes to do is consolidate its local headquarters, if you like. So Germiston, or Ekurhuleni, as you know, is spread over a number of previous municipalities. They're trying to consolidate with their council precinct, if you like, in Germiston. And we are supporting that plan. We paid for the development of the feasibility studies and the business planning. And we are also using Germiston as the pilot program for our priority housing development areas. And then the Northern Cape is a project where we're assisting the Northern Cape to finally get to grips with what actually the extent of their requirements are in terms of upgrading and other dealing with the backlog that they have, and that is also coming together in quite a significant way, particularly over the recent weeks, and we are in the process of packaging for the department to put forward the Northern Cape as part of the kind of priority project program going forward. And that finally then concludes what our kind of imprint is on the South African map and what we hope constitutes kind of establishing the footprint of the HDA. Just to move to the financial side, Madam Chair, we received a grant from the city. From the National Department. My apologies. We received a grant from the National Department. We have spent last year approximately 43 million of that. The surplus was 19 million, which was acquired by virtue of virement because of the takeover of the various obligations from in particular ServCon. That hasn't yet been spent because of the delays in taking over. But again, you will see from the audit that we received, aside from that one little matter of note that I mentioned, a clean audit. They have found that expenditure was in order. They have found that compliance was in order, and we're very pleased to have achieved that in our first year. So finally, Madam Chair and Committee, we have settled through the board on that vision and that mission. We've been working towards that through all the activities that I've just outlined. The vision of the HTA is sustainable human settlements and communities developed on land made available by the HTA, and our mission is a public development agency that promotes sustainable communities and integrated human settlements through the provision of well-located and appropriately planned lands and buildings. And then if I can just quickly take you through some of the visuals around what we've been doing. That's some of our projects in the Northern Cape, in the N2, some workshops. We've been doing some very nice workshops on best practices. We've had really good participation by provincial and local authorities in areas around land, around project management. The project management ones have been very good, where we've been bringing people from the various big metros. So the Ekurhuleni officials have come down to the Western Cape and have worked with Western Cape officials to learn both best and worst practice and how you deal with those issues on big mega projects, and that's been very useful. Similarly, we brought together a whole range of people working with informal settlement upgrades and just starting to share the lessons about those things, as well as how you acquire land within the State Department framework. And again, we'll be starting to codify those into best practice lessons, which will be available. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I will stop there.
Thank you very much, CEO. That was precise and clear. I think I have to give the opportunity to the members to interact. Honorable Bowman, Honorable Figlan, for now.
Yes, thank you very much. That is very clear, and it was a good idea to put that up like that. I can see your reasoning behind that. It certainly shows that you're covering the ground. Just a couple of things throughout your report, well, in a number of places in your report, and you've alluded to it now, is that you're awaiting signatures, political signatures. Are those genuine hold-ups, or is it just part of a process? Is there some way in which, you know, we as a committee can assist you there? That's the one thing. The other thing I want to refer to is your board. The board meetings, and I want to also refer to your audit committee. I noticed that a person by the name of Kay Gordon and Nueda Muchu, something, have attended very few meetings. Now, whilst there have been apologies, one wonders how, why they're still sitting there if they are obviously unable to attend. And the Kay Gordon, I noticed in the audit committee, hasn't attended either of the two. So if, we could just have some explanation about that. And then just one other one, the N2 gateway, and it was very good to read in the report of the progress there and your confirmation of that today. Can I just ask you, in the progress that you are making and the working together, which is hugely important, have the backlogs in the problem areas been repaired, rectified? Is that complete as you move forward, or is that part of your moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I've been covered with a few questions that I had. But the main question that I want to find out is about the progress that has been made in the N2 gateway. According to the paper, I think a very good job is done on the paper, but on the ground, it doesn't look like that. In the N2 gateway at the flats in Langa, that place is not controlled. And there are a lot of people. I think it's a sabotage problem, probably. Now I'm a little bit concerned about the N2 gateway because their project is in my heart. Now, there's a lot of things happening there. Please stop your phone. Mine is off. Now, since you say you've taken control of the N2 gateway, there are a lot of people who are staying there without permission, and there's a lot of robberies happening. Now, I felt there is no control that you have taken over. The second issue I want to find out is about the Boys Town project. The last time we met, we were given 3 months that the project was kickstart. Now, to my knowledge, nothing is happening at this point in time. Then the last question that I want to find out is, how much land did we identify through all these provinces, if we can have the number? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
You mentioned the possibility of additional offices. What I'd like to know is, when do you identify the need for an additional office? Is it when you enter into some sort of negotiations with a municipality? Is it when you've identified a project that you may be involved in or manage? So when do you actually say, well, we're going to need an office there? And I'm asking this question because, and I'm not sure which entity it was, and it may very well have been NHBRC, I'm not sure, where sometimes you need two employees who could possibly be placed in a government office somewhere in that particular area instead of you going out and sourcing offices. So that's why I'm asking that. Then, to link on to a question asked by my colleague here, the one of the things you said was delays with the transfer of the Servcon properties, and in discussion was, I thought Servcon didn't exist any longer. So why would they have to? I can understand discussions with Treasury, but you actually mentioned with Servcon as well. And perhaps you can give us some information there, because, I mean, we need to put these sort of things to bed. We can't just carry on and on and on, and if we can assist in any way, then I think you need to let us know. The other concern that I do have, and whilst I understand that your mandate is beyond just looking at state-owned land, and you mentioned purchases in Bella Bella, for example, is that our first priority is obviously to identify state-owned land, because then we hopefully won't have to pay for it. And the second, obviously, if there aren't enough suitable land, is then to go to the private sector. But I would like for us to exhaust, obviously get an audit of all state-owned land, and then exhaust that suitable land that is available as far as state-owned land is concerned. You've mentioned somewhere in the report about regulations that I think you may have completed, and it's with, maybe with the minister. If I'm not mistaken, we very specifically put in this bill that it must be in consultation with the committee. To my knowledge, we haven't seen any regulations. So if at some point we could obviously have a draft. Your sponsored workshop, you did sort of preempt my question and explained it somewhat. But what I want to put to you here is, you know, we don't want to have workshops for the sake of having workshops. When officials from other spheres are identified, I'm hoping that they are involved in projects where whatever they learn from that workshop will stand them in good stead, rather than them going off to a workshop and they go back to their offices and for the next year or so, you know, they don't actually use that knowledge. So I think it needs to be targeted, exchange of knowledge. Then, just two more, Chair. you, if I'm not mistaken, you mentioned that you've got a staff complement of 74. That may well be after this, your annual report indicates 65, so I presume it's some additional staff. Related to that, there's one individual that is an unknown, which I find strange. If you can explain that. Why is there one employee who is unknown? Somebody from Mars? That we still have to give a... and then, related to your staff, you've got... And please, I may be wrong here, but I think you've got recruitment fees of 2.5 million. That presumably is what was paid to agencies to recruit staff. Now, I have been a little bit concerned in when, you know, every now and then you hear from somebody that is taken from particularly the National Department or even another entity that's now with HDA, and then 2 months later that person is no longer with HDA as well. It is of some concern because, and it's not just in HDA, it's generally for me. We seem to have a situation where when an employee wants to leave and they may have a five-year contract, then they can give a month's notice and off they go. But when we, and I'm talking about we as an employer, want to terminate the employment of somebody that's got a five-year contract, say 1 year into the contract, we often have to pay them out for the rest of their contract. Now, to me, there's no balance there. You know, somebody signs up, and obviously one doesn't want to curtail the progress of people. But, you know, if you sign a two-year contract, then unless it's absolutely necessary, and presumably your skills were required, that it shouldn't be that easy to just go job hopping, so to speak. So just your views on that as well, please. And then I've got a similar concern that again, my colleague has said, I've looked at the directors here, and the one stands out in particular. But linked to that, is there a relationship between the attendance of board meetings or other meetings and their remuneration? Because even though those two people that was mentioned attended the same number of meetings, their remuneration was different. Now, there may be other reasons why, but just curious. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. We put in the unknown to see if Mr. Stain read the report carefully. And I'm glad that he performed his duty admirably and came to the party. But on that one, basically, the particular person refused to declare his racial group. So we put it in as an unknown. His racial group. So we didn't know quite how to classify it, so we put it in that manner. I think, Chair, in the way that we've done it in the past, if I could answer some of the questions and then give to the members of my executive team to answer to their areas of responsibility. On the board governance areas, there are, as you've noted, two people whose attendance records are not reflecting well, and of course that's the reason why one has reports like this. That has been discussed with the chair of the HDA, and we are in the process of addressing that. In some situations, I think there will be justifiable reasons, which I would hopefully be able to report on afterwards. There is a relationship between board attendance and board remuneration. You don't come to the meeting, you don't get paid. Beginning and end of story, and that's accepted. I say if you don't come to a meeting, you don't get paid. Performance related. I think if I could then ask, and perhaps we'll take them one of the burning questions was around the N2 in particular, so if I could ask Adet to just deal with those questions because it's her area of responsibility.
Thank you, Chair. I'll
talked to the Joe Slovo Park flats first and then Boys Town, and then there's the third question around the areas, but I may need some clarity on that one. In terms of the Into Gateway, there are about six different sites currently operating in Phase 1. Our contract and the handover from Tbilisi has been on projects where there is running construction, and we have concluded agreements and tied those projects down. They are completely handed over from Tbilisi to the province and accordingly to ourselves. Joe Slovo Park, the rental flats, at 705 flats, there is a management contract that sits with the City of Cape Town, and it is the one contract that has not yet been concluded. We cannot legally do anything in that site in terms of turning around, dealing with the capital works and the rectification works and dealing with the property management until the proper legal arrangements have been concluded. And that is a process we are currently underway with the city. And there is also an element where we need a direction and mandate from national, which we've got an answer to. So we are processing that last legal component. What we have been doing is emergency measures in the property, and there is a presence on site recording, capturing, and as of the last 2 months, the tenants have started engaging with us through their tenant committee. But we cannot do anything actively to turn around on that site because the legal handover hasn't happened, so we have no rights on that property as it stands at the moment. Those rights are between the City of Cape Town and the legal entity and closure team of Tbilisi. And until that is resolved, we cannot take any action there. There is a turnaround plan. All the parties have seen the plan. They are comfortable with the plan and the measures. It's really just the legal handover, which is pending. And to date, Chair, there is a steering committee of the N2, and I know it's on the agenda in that meeting. So it is a concern for all the spheres that the park hasn't been turned around, the rental flats. On Boys Town, when we last met, we were at a point where contracts were being concluded between Province and Mvula, the contractors for Boys Town. That contracting process has been concluded. Social complex with that community have been signed and are in place. We were on site as of yesterday. The groundworks and clearing of a part of the Boys Town site is happening, and that will happen for the next couple of months before any house construction will be happening. And our team is actively involved in clearing the site where the groundworks will be happening so that the machinery can come in and actually do an aggressive clearing and infrastructure works can start on that site. So there is a movement, and we can provide more detail or take you through if you require more information. In terms of the backlogs in the problem areas and the repairs and rectification, I understand two parts, and this is where I may need some clarity. In terms of allocation of beneficiaries and where the groupings are coming for the Into Gateway, as I indicated, there's six different sites. In the agreement between the province and city, the sites are specified, and the areas from where beneficiaries who will be allocated to the units are predefined and contracted with the city. So, for example, the people who will be allocated to the Joe Slovo site will come from the city's allocation list and are defined from the Joe Slovo area. And we are operating and allocating people in terms of that agreement because it's something that has not changed in the entire Into Gateway. So what is a challenge is apart from the lists that we have and the allocations that are happening there, there are additional people who are coming into the area. And with through the allocations committee and with the province and the city, we are working out how to deal with the additional people who are coming in versus the people who were originally on the list and the source areas that are defined, and that is a challenge in the Into Gateway. So that's on the beneficiary side. In terms of the existing projects, works that have been done and physical rectifications or the repairs or anything that are on site, part of that is captured in the contractual handover of the contracts from Tbilisi to the province and the province's negotiations with the two contractors that are operating actively, Somba Mbisana and Ibuyile, on the site. The main concerning project is Del Symphony 4 and 6, where there are quite a number of issues with the units. That is in a mediation process between the province and the contractor involved and will yield the solution to sorting out those problems. Some of the issues relating to electricity and short-term, easily rectifiable issues have been addressed, but essentially that is in a mediation process between the province and the contractor concerned, and we are keeping an eye on that so that there isn't a health and safety risk to the beneficiaries.
on the other side, together with the contractor, measures have been put in place to begin to record and progressively address the physical rectification issues in line with the contractual arrangements that exist with the contractor. So we are working through that. I wouldn't say it's all completed, but there's definitely a process, and there is much more pressure and management and control of the contractors and the consortium that are involved in the N2 gateway. The works on Joe Slovo, the Concord component, again, the community surveys have been completed. The contracting with the contractor has been concluded, and the open site works will be starting on the open site, pending the town planning approval from the city, which has also taken and been done in the last couple of months. So there will be movement in that area, and again, a different arrangement from what was in the past with the N2 gateway. There was one other question about the workshop, Steffi, if I could just cover that one. Correctly, as you indicated, we don't want to have workshops for the sake of workshops. We draw on our projects as a basis to inform a workshop of any kind. So where we're doing informal settlement work and we have learning and best practice, we raise that to the level of the workshop, and we draw in the other project role players that we are working with. Instead of bringing them one by one to the projects, we bring them together in a workshop format to expose them, to share experiences, and then we take it back to the projects that we are working with within. Potential partners we also bring into the workshops, and we share experiences so that we can begin to build a relationship of supporting and providing services to them at their projects and in their specific projects. So it's definitely not workshops for the sake of workshops, but very targeted and framed around our partners and strengthening the knowledge base and experience of our partners so that they can implement better and we can help them implement better.
Thanks. Madam Chair, just on the N2, I mean, you know, I think there were something like 60 agreements, 74 agreements that we had to work through. There was a business plan that hadn't been completed. There was an environment where we had a steering committee which the city wasn't part of. And you had a whole range of communities that were frustrated because they weren't getting involved. Now, all of those things have taken inevitably more time than anyone would have wanted them to start to put onto the right track, which is not necessarily the fast track, but it's, we think, definitely the right track. And the situation now, Chair, is that the responsible authority in the N2 is the province. The province chairs the steering committee, the province chairs the communications committee. The city is partnering and bringing in its expertise and requirements around the funding for the MIG and all those sorts of elements. So there will be gaps. There's absolutely no doubt. And I think it must be fair to say that we're only beginning to see the train starting to gather momentum. And I hope that certainly by the early part of next year, and hopefully the committee then will perhaps want to come and look at it, there will be much more significant progress. The major blockages, aside from the kind of relationship issues right through the project, have been tying out or moving through the contractual arrangement. We had court disputes, we had all sorts of things, and the last remaining bits of those are in fact just over facts, which unfortunately is the lens that everybody sees the N2 through. But that's 750 units in a project of 22,000. So it's one has to deal with that as a reality. Hopefully we'll be able to change the lens going forward. Could I ask Joe Lishwani just to deal with the land issues?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning. I think it is possible to confirm three things. The one being that while we keep referring to the self-conf property portfolio, we do so in the context that it was a priority in the last financial year. We had set ourselves and geared ourselves to take over that portfolio. Now that we don't have it, we're merely confirming that it is not with us at this point, pending the final legal issues of the closure of CERCOL. Secondly, Madam Chair, we have identified state land across all provinces, and I just want to give you a summary, which in a sense points to the 28,000 hectares identified in the first instance. And I'm saying first instance because this is ongoing work. We've identified these, we have made submissions to request the release of these, and further work has been done. I can confirm that in the last quarter, in this quarter that just ended, the second quarter of the year, a further 8,000 hectares have been identified. So that's ongoing work that we engaged within. What this means, Madam Chair, is that as we identify state land and request for its release, that release may take some time. So that is why the identification process, which includes, is quite involved in the sense of feasibility checks and assessments and so forth, and site inspections and all that. All that it means is that out of the 28,000 hectares requested, we are likely to get probably 80% of that. And then the next round of submission will also yield certain portions. What I just want to demonstrate, Madam Chair, which is the last response, is that while the release of state land is priority and continues to be priority, what we need not lose sight of is that state land on its own may not be sufficient in a particular locality to respond meaningfully to settlement issues. If I may just take 1 minute to just demonstrate this question, because it's a very, it's an important area, and sometimes we just bump heads unnecessarily. So I just want to use the example of properties identified in Gauteng, just so that we can just pardon me here. Right. Madam Chair, in Gauteng, there are several properties identified across the province. You will see in this instance, this is in Pretoria West, just almost adjacent to the N4, but on the northeast of Atteridgeville. We've isolated one portion, which is what is highlighted there in the yellow line. Adjacent to that is properties that are privately owned. So if you have to consolidate that settlement, you need to consider, from a planning and land use point of view, not just that state piece of state land. You need to consider properties around that and then begin to say, what will it take to create an integrated settlement in that area so that the investment that is made in the first instance from an infrastructure station point of view makes sense for the entire area and not just for that piece of land. Similarly, Madam Chair, the famous site, the site of the Soccer World Cup final, that precinct, the Nazareth precinct, is state-owned. However, there are portions that are undeveloped. We believe they may be appropriate for settlement development, but taken on their own, they don't make sense. And I'll point you to this sort of portion to the east of the stadium there. There's a golf course. Okay, that ran away. There's a golf course adjacent to that. On the south, there's those suburbs of Mondio and Omonde. But all that, in isolation, that piece of state land is not functional. So you can release that, but we need to consider how we combine and consolidate that with surrounding areas to make a meaningful impact in an area. So those are the issues at play, Madam Chair. State land is priority, and that's what we are going after. We are simply aware from a planning and functional point of view that on its own state land is not always sufficient. And therefore, that's why the discussions are underway with the department around capitalizing the agency to be able to acquire privately owned property. Madam Chair, I will pause there. Those were the questions that were put to us in relation to land and how much land has been identified across provinces. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honorable Davade, and then Honorable...
We hadn't answered some of the questions. There were some other questions that we hadn't answered.
It does follow up on the state land matter. And then because I think the chair has given us the breakdown. But I'm not sure that this breakdown is a suitable land for human settlement or the totality of the land that we have identified. Because I think what we are much more interested on is the land that will be suitable for human settlement. The land that is suitable for farming, I think there will be farmers to do that. I think Tafi can be a farmer yesterday, tomorrow. But I think it's important that we do that because it would assist us as a committee just to understand. And then when we act on some of the issues, the point that you are raising, that the state land alone won't resolve our problem. Therefore, simply suggest that I think you have already started to engage with the private sector because a lot of the land, I think most of the land is owned by the private sector anyway. And therefore, the pieces that are owned by the state, I'm not sure that are suitable for human settlement, or just pieces that would be suitable for golf courses and all that. But not every land, anyway, is suitable for human settlement. And I think we'll assist us, the chair, just to take us through on that process. Out of the 28,000, and then I think how many portions that would say are suitable for human settlement, bearing in mind the point that you are raising, that are also adjacent areas that are owned by private sector that have not engaged. And then also, what would be your strategy of engaging the private sector? And of course, the land will be very expensive. There's no doubt it will be very expensive. But surely, I think we have already identified the owners, the private owners of particular land, like the golf course anywhere between Mondi and Boise. The land that is available, I guess, but it's a privately owned land. Surely, it must be a very expensive land because it's a private land, generally speaking. And then that will be very important for us to have all that information. Because I guess that I'm not sure how long it's going to take us anyway to have a very composite report that will assist us to say. And I know that the agent is very young, I think doing well. I guess that we'll reach a stage all of us will be comfortable that this is a state land. We think development will take place here. And then these are resources in terms of department, whatever structure that are responsible for that. Just for all of us to be comfortable, if it's correct to say, and the backlog, I'm not sure if it's correct anyway, Mohamed will correct me, and I attended your conference with the chair in Sandton, that you are saying the backlog is about 2.2 million. And then if the backlog at this time is 2.2 million, and then the state-owned land in all provinces is 28,000 hectares, I guess. That's what is the issue, or 28,000 portions. And then I think we should reach a stage when we are told, anyway, in this 28,000 and then portions, we think we can be able to accommodate 20,000 units or 100,000 or 1 million units. I think we should really go to detail. Because it's at that level that would be comfortable where they would be able to make a dent in terms of the backlog that is increasing almost every year. If that is the correct anyway. I'm not sure whether... I think the department is correct to say that is a backlog of 2.2 something million. and therefore it's a lot of work really that would need almost many years to do. Then these agents, in my view, must really be speeding up that process. Because otherwise the backlog would be 3 million very soon. Like in 10 years down the line, it would be 3 million. And therefore, you are almost shooting a moving target. I think it would be a very big big problem for us. And I'm just happy that the other organs that will be giving us more information about this, the finance one and other people. But that's the point that I wanted just to raise. And I bear in mind that we are a very new agent, but I think we have laid the foundation now. I think we should be assisting us that in 12 months' time, we'll come to us and say, this is the totality of the land that we have identified. This is a suitable land, it's not suitable. There's engagement with private sector, they are compatible with some of these issues or not. I think to me that would really assist us a lot. Then we'll know, and then that we can then build 20,000, 50,000 units, and then accommodate how many thousands of people. I think that would therefore be telling us that there will be progress in 10, 5, or 15 years' time. And otherwise, really, it's just an information that is very useful, but doesn't take us to make an impact or even a dent in what is the backlog in the community or society. That's the point that I wanted just to make a comment. We may also comment in 12 months' time when we meet again. Thanks, sir.
Okay, thanks. Another comment? Was there a follow-up? Was that your question? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I think Babu Mdaran has covered me because I'm your
husband. Madam Chair, I think the committee may need to be rest assured that out of the 121 million hectares land space that is South Africa, just about 13.5 million hectares of that is state-owned. We are harvesting out of that 13 million hectares what is considered to be suitable for human settlement. So the 28,000 hectares that have been identified is what we regard as suitable. And that's not vacant land, let me assert, because in some cases, it's land that is occupied. If you look at the area such as Umtata, it's state land, it's held in trust. The municipality has no ability whatsoever to do the necessary work that a municipality should do because just of the land tenure arrangements. We've also identified those sort of pieces of land to say that land is released, then you are able to institute tenure upgrading in those areas to resolve the human settlement questions and the service delivery questions that confront the municipality. So it's not just, Madam Chair, vacant land. In some cases, yes, it's vacant land. In some cases, it's occupied land, which will allow for tenure upgrading. But, Madam Chair, also supporting this work in the agency is very, we believe, robust systems. We have a comprehensive land and property special information system that is operational. We also have a national human settlements land inventory, which tells us about areas that are habitable in the country. And therefore, these are tools that are available within the agency that we are operating and building. So we would be in a position, 12 months may be too far, we would much rather come back much sooner share with yourself that sort of work. But rest assured, Madam Chair, that is the extent of our work. Thank you.
There were some other issues relating to HR and recruitment, etc. So I wonder if I could ask our CFO to just answer those quickly.
Thank you. Regarding the recruitment fees, we do pay an agency for recruitment because we are quite new and we don't have the staff complement to deal with that at the moment. We're actually paying a discounted rate. Also to just bear in mind that the I was the first staff member to be appointed in April, and since then at head office, we've got around 30 people or so, and most of them are in senior management. So the fees for that particular year are quite high, although we're obviously keeping an eye on it and managing that particular process. As far as contracts go, all our staff, except the two executive directors, which is the CEO, CFO, are permanent. We are on 5-year contracts, but the rest are all permanent, and certainly we would make sure, and we really do try to make the staff as comfortable as possible so that we can retain them for as long as we can. And so far, we haven't really had any resignations. Where we've had people leave, it's more in the current year rather than the past financial year. One of our big losses was obviously Mr. Neville Cheney, who was the CEO now for housing. But other than that, we really are managing to retain our staff, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm sure you started to watch the talk, but just to go through some other specific questions that were raised. On the question of the regulations, yes, they will obviously come through to the committee for discussion, and we'll deal with that. On the question of offices, at the moment, all three offices are offices that we inherited, so they were based on projects. We will be quite wary of establishing independent offices unless there is significant enough demand. We now have a fairly good idea of what it costs to run an office. And at the moment, perhaps in recognition of that, our travel bill is comparatively high. And that's when you start to look at the cost-benefit analysis of having an office. And it's really only when there's justification for staff to service a particular area that we'll move there. And so far, we haven't established any new offices. The other question that was asked was around the signatories of agreements. Those generally have been processed with the relevant departments. I think as activity has come, then there's been a recognition that there's a need to get an agreement in place. So increasingly, rather than have or where there's just been the idea of let's have an agreement, that's when they've tended to founder a bit. Where there's been a specific activity, could you be as a case in point or KZN, and there's been pressure to say, well, let's actually formalize the relationship, the signature has come comparatively quickly. But certainly we would welcome the offer, and hopefully we'll come to you if we do need support. And then finally, Madam Chair, if I can just go back to the land question. Obviously, this particular session was about what we've done in the past year. We will, I think, in the coming year, be able to capture much more, and a lot of our time and effort has been spent around the directive, around the outcome 8 of the presidential commitments to identify 6,050 hectares of land, of well-located state-owned land, publicly owned land is the term that's used, and we spent a lot of time doing that, and as Joe has indicated, we have a really powerful system to be able to do that now. Sometimes where there have been blockages, they have been in the kind of formal relationships, and I'm not sure if you want to give the department the chance to talk about the surf fund allocations, because that might be something of interest, but there have been contractual blockages. Those are being unblocked, if you like, by virtue of our discussions with, in particular, Public Works, Rural Development, State-Owned Enterprises, where we have now got a set of criteria. Everybody recognizes this is the land that we're looking for, and we have agreed a procedure in terms of which land would be identified and allocated across, and that is currently being processed, and hopefully we'll be able to present progress on that going forward.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Sorry for coming up so late. During the presentation, You mentioned the objects of the HDA, and you said that the last object there, which is the provision of all infrastructure required for housing, is quite difficult to implement or to achieve. I would like to find out, actually, what does it entail? What does it entail? If you could give a few examples of what exactly it entails so that we can understand why it is difficult to achieve or to implement. But Chairperson, out of the discussion that has just happened, in particular with regard to how much land is likely to be available for human settlements in the country as a whole, I find it very worrisome when we look at some of the housing projects that we have in the country. And you find that although the houses themselves may look quite, good, not necessarily the best, but at least they can look good and reasonable, but they are very, very crowded. So crowded that I sometimes wonder, really, how we expect the people who are going to occupy them to live comfortable and at peace with each other as neighbors in such crowded settlements. But if we are saying that we should be comfortable, that we think we've got enough land to settle our people, my question then would be, why is it that we crowd some of these areas so much? And you see, it's sad in a way, because these are the very people who themselves cannot afford, for instance, to buy land or buy houses in areas where there is space. We are saying that we are trying to help our people also to enjoy the freedom that we have gained, so that we provide, you know, the kind of housing that will make them also comfortable. These are the houses and comfort. But they are so crowded. I'm sorry, I can't, I don't have a definite example. But one has seen them, for instance, sometimes pictures on TV or sometimes the actual settlements themselves. And you wonder, really, that if we are trying to provide for our people, if we are trying also to make our people realize that, yes, all of us in South Africa, so we say we are equal, but we are not necessarily equal. But at least that is what we are working towards. Why do we crowd, you know, these houses so much? There's hardly space, you know. There's hardly space in some of them between the houses. Are we expecting these people to live in those houses for years and years and years? And those of us who can afford our own houses, we've got plenty of land around our houses, we've got gardens, flower gardens, and all that kind of thing. I'm just saying, is it necessary to crowd them like this? Can't you space them a little bit in such a way that, you know, families are comfortable and people can be proud of what we give them? This may not necessarily belong to HDA to answer all the questions, but it's something that I think really...
But they take part in the planning process.
Be aware.
In terms of their mandate, in terms of their function, they do take part in the planning process. Don't worry, Mama. I'm going to answer that one. I think it's a follow-up. I think this is the last of the last, because we still have two more
I wanted to pick up on that infrastructure question as well, and it's been a concern in this committee, hugely so. I know what we're talking about here and the complications in trying to work with so many different departments. And my question here in the challenges that you are facing, do you see, we don't want to end up with a situation, we've been talking all along that it's going to happen, and it's going to happen, it's going to happen, that we, you know, But there doesn't seem to be any particular driving force. Now, my understanding is that maybe this should be in the office of the presidency, in, you know, the monitoring committee and the planning committee. So I want to know, because now you are practically working with this in trying to. So I think we do need to understand, you know, how that is going to work, and that we don't always come here and say, yes, but this isn't working because this is complicated. So I think we do. Chair, I just want to refer to your table 2 in your report, where you talk about the signed LAA in the Western Cape has been withdrawn by the Western Province. And then also, just further down the page, your middle income housing, you've got a comment there. There's a 350 million rand value put on this, and the developer is in financial distress. I wonder if we could have a little bit more clarity on that. And just one other quickie about Cornuvia. And we are moving now to be developing these integrated developments, and we were very pleased to be part, to be able to see the one in Gauteng, the city, what do we call that? Cosmo City. Now, my concern is you talk about 55,000 residential units, which are to be of a different values, you know, your RDPs through to your mid-incomes. Who is going to plan and control the numbers there? Because I know that we are sitting with huge numbers in the informal settlements that are all expecting to be moving in there. Who is going to be controlling the mix that we get in that city that's going to be developing there?
I think in your responses, can you also give us the provinces that we that are delayed the signing of these written agreements? Because when we were in the provinces conducting our oversight, we found that really we were questioning a lot the availability of HDA. You would get a sense that from the province that there's no hands-on in other areas. So we need to gather so that we can assist to put pressure at least to on those provinces to make sure that they will be closer with the agent, with the agents.
Thanks, Madam Chair. In relation to the infrastructure question, what one would be talking about would be after you've got the raw land, how do you make it available for development? And that would include the roads. It would include the water pipelines, the sewage pipelines, the electricity, those sorts of elements which are required. And we don't begin to have control over those things. They're controlled by an Eskom, or they're controlled by a local authority, or they're controlled by SANRAL or the province. So it becomes quite difficult to merely talk about being the central coordinator of those elements in general broad terms. What I think we can do, and what we are increasingly in a position to do, would be on a project by project basis. To make sure, for example, that no houses are built where there aren't roads or sewage lines, and that has happened in the past. So that increasingly, where we are involved in a project, one would make sure that at the coordinating level, that particular project has at least thought about and planned for those elements to come in the right order, and try to make sure that the funding is in place for all of that. So I hope that would answer the question on the infrastructure issues. I think on comfortable houses, basically what the member is talking about is densification. And there's a huge debate on that question. I fear the reality is that densification is the reality of the 21st century. And unless you can afford it and you're going to go out into the countryside with a big house, the vast majority of people coming into the cities are going to be living in smaller and smaller spaces and making better and better use of those issues. But that's a big debate which we can go into. Specifically on the question of the Western Cape Land Availability Agreement, what I'd want to say there is that the land question is being resolved in terms of the discussions about the second phase of the N2. The province seems quite satisfied to let it go that route. Aside from the formal letter, there has been no further formal interaction on a disputual nature. And certainly, I was in a conference which was addressed by both the Deputy Minister and the Premier of the Western Cape, and the Premier publicly mentioned that the HDA was assisting the province to acquire 7 pieces of public land in the Western Cape. So I put that in just to cover us, Madam Chair, but it doesn't seem to be an issue at this point in time. I'm sure that if things became conflictual around the M2 in particular, or we weren't able to help with the land, but at the moment there's a very good working relationship in the Western Cape, and it is around the second phase of the N2 dealing with land acquisition issues in a cordial and intergovernmental way. I think it may already have fallen away. But that's not to say that the documentation is not in place in case it doesn't fall away. Fred, that is there. In relation to the question of Cornubia and the allocations there, unless I'm wrong, and that it will correct me, there will be a number of relationships related to the piece of land that will be made available for different kinds of development. Certainly the local authority is taking responsibility for the development of houses aimed at the low-income sector and will be responsive to the waiting list that the city has. The first 5,000 houses are in the process of the planning has certainly been done, and they're about to be commenced, the construction is about to commence. Sorry, 500 houses, but it's part of the bigger RDP allocation, and the province has made the money available, and the city will control that in the first phase. But then, in the same way as it happened in Cosmo, land that will be agreed between the different parties, and the major parties to the agreement, the land agreements are currently Tonga Tulit and the city and the province, will decide which portions are available for what kind of income developments, and they will then make that available. In terms of the actual provinces that we're working with, we have signed agreements with the Free State, with Limpopo. West Cape is almost signed. Northern Cape is signed. And I think that's all that is signed. And the Eastern Cape is signed. And the balance are in discussion.
I think we... Table 2 at the bottom there, the developer.
Madam Chair, just very briefly, this table merely records the, I'll call it, transactions that are coming through the agency. You will see the records that as at end of March 2010, we have not acquired any property, we have not expropriated any, so it records all of those. In this regard,
We were approached by several developers whose projects were in distress because their credit lines were either being withdrawn or suspended given the financial dip. Now, in this particular case, one developer formally made an approach and submitted to us to say, here's a project, I'm in dire straits, can you take it over? So that's what we are recording. We couldn't process that, but we are recording that such approaches were made to the agency. Thank you, Madam Chair.
No, we didn't pay.
Okay. Now, thank you very much, Honorable Member, for your introduction, and to the HDA. I think we are really observing an improvement. We are very much impressed as a portfolio committee because we are a new baby, to be honest. You are only 1 year. Yes, they say they are only 1 year, right?
Yeah.
At least you can't expect a baby to be crawling at 1 year. But now we are seeing a baby that is trying a little bit to crawl. So I think we are impressed as a portfolio committee, and you have the support. And we know that the department is also assisting you a lot. So we are also pledging our support to the HDA because really the establishment of this HDA is very much crucial. And I think the objective of creating of establishing was a good one. So we trust that you are going to
get there.
Thank you.
Chair, just one last. Thank you for your support. We have copies of the presentation, which we'll give to the secretary
for
members to get if they wish it.
Okay. Mr. Mona, how are you? Are you all right? Are you connected, or you would like to be connected? Can I give you a few seconds? Okay. Members can just take
Where did you get your photos?
Sorry?
Where did you get your photos from Parliament?
I think they must have got it from the Parliament website.
Right.
So I think these are really old photos. I don't think anyone changes the photos.
Okay. Let me see.
But of knows this committee, so I don't really need this. Yeah, I think that's the same photo.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
So wait, when did you have that taken?
That was last year.
Okay, so it's not
that
relatively
was in
new.
2009.
Relatively new.
You know, when you first register as MPs, they take this photo. So that's, yes, I can see what I'm wearing there.
Yeah, the same.
And so I think with that in mind, these are the outcomes in terms of the results of our achievements for 2009 and 2010. But I will come back to each one of those in terms of housing opportunities created, number of beneficiaries benefiting, the funding impact that we have made, and what we're able to leverage from other partners who put in their money together with us, and the number of jobs that we have created. I think what is key, Madam Chair, is a historical performance, which is really the graph that we've put in place just to indicate in terms of cumulative housing opportunities that we've created over the period. Much as cumulatively it has gone up, but we can look specifically in 2009 and 2010 and we will see that the environment was actually difficult for that period. Once more, the specifics about the environment, not only was it a economic downturn, there were some job losses which affect the people that were able to receive financing from us. We saw a lot of over-indebtedness that led to declining disposable income. And also we have been having a low interest rate environment, which also is positive for the end user, but I think in terms of income for the corporation is actually on the reverse side thereof. But Madam Chair, even in 2010, there were some good things that happened in 2010 besides the World Cup. It has been a year where some of the goals that we set for ourselves were able actually to attain. One was to obtain external funding so that it can augment the funding that NHSC had with the funding we got from AFD. And we've also seen a significant ability to get more money put on the table by other co-funders with us to the tune of about 1.3 million, billion, especially in the incremental side, which also extended the impact that we had in the market during the same period. And one of our projects we were just highlighting, which is the one that you opened last week, actually won, was voted to be a Housing Foundation project of the year for 2009. And I may also hasten to say, Madam Chair, as we speak yesterday, on Wednesday we got a message that another project of NHSC has won for 2010 the same accolade, which means the Minister's got another job to do in terms of launching that project soon. That is a project in Western Cape this time, not in Rustenburg. And I hope that time I'll fly my jet here and just match David Brown's performance. Well, Madam Chair, I don't want to belabor the issue of the factors of or impacting the performance, but I think what I want to highlight here is the volume of total business was lower, even though better than last year, but in terms of the volume that we set for ourselves. But you also saw the value of loans, especially in incremental housing, being bigger, which meant that people took bigger loans to be able to do renovations or extend their homes instead of taking smaller loans on a continuous basis. So what that did is it reduced the number of loans but increased the value. So if one looks at the total value of disbursement in commercial, you realize that the total disbursement is very high, except that the number of loans are low, but it's simply because individual loans were larger than what we anticipated. Retail business, that's the business which was responsible for the Rustenburg project, that was reduced as we had planned. And I think the market issue I have highlighted. In brief, Madam Chair, I've broken down our performance according to our business in projects. I've indicated what we have approved and what we're able to disperse. And as you can see in projects, we're mostly very close in terms of approvals to disbursement. It's almost in the 90% success rate. And commercial also is very close in terms of the value side. But impact side is slightly different, as I indicated, because the loans were larger, even though the values were high. And then retail, I think that because we're slowing down the business, that's why even the approvals vis-a-vis the disbursement, there's been a differential in that regard. I think the other success story that we can speak about, Madam Chair, is the strategic partnership which have assisted the corporation to extend its impact. Firstly, community housing companies. I must mention that last time when we presented this report, I was advised and warned by the committee to say manage it very well so that you can get an impact through that institution. And as we speak, there's a new business model on the table for the Cape Town Community Housing Company. We've actually relooked at their whole business model. We came to a conclusion that the previous model does not work because it had a lot of dependency to the city in terms of land being allocated or subsidies being given, and it's not a viable model if that were to stand on its own. So the approach that we're adopting now is they need to raise up their game plan to an extent that they should actually take on projects that are viable and that will cost the institution to be turned around in the next 2 to 3 years. But secondly, in strategic partnership, Trust for Urban Housing Finance, this is an institution that we helped set up since 2003. And NHFC, through this institution, has been able to raise it with 10 million to a point where this institution has a book now of 1 billion. And predominantly in the inner city of Johannesburg, but the extensions are now going to Durban and also to Port Elizabeth. Now, the model we think is working, and it's working fine because this one is not subsidized. And I think later I'll comment around, I heard HDA mentioning the fact that densification is an answer for two models. It's something that we need to be emphasizing going forward. I think I do agree, but densification speaks to rental. And I don't think rental, the biggest challenge with rental is how do we fund it on a sustainable basis? Because if in terms of all the rental housing development projects that are on the go as we speak, none of those are without government subsidy being injected in there. And therefore, if one leaves the inner city and the affordable housing rental market, one can see that without government's hand in rental housing development, there will be a challenge in terms of actually funding viable projects. But anyway, I'll raise it later on because I think it's an issue that we need to, we are putting before the committee, because I think it is significant. The third strategic partnership is that of Housing Investment Partnership, where we partner with Old Mutual and another private equity firm. And I must say, Madam Chair, we're successful in leveraging funding from Old Mutual, investing into this company with our investment only of about 25%, and the rest of the 75% is coming from private sector players. I think I'll ask the CFO just to talk us through the financials.
On our statement, a brief statement of the financial position, our key assets include our loans and receivables, and you would notice the growth from the previous year for the group, or maybe just as a PM to say the difference, the significant difference between the group and the company is our subsidiary, which is the CHC, which might include some activities that's not included in the company. Loans and receivables were if you look at our key assets on our balance sheet, it is our advances, and it would indicate that for the group, it's grown by 27% from the 1.053 to the 1.333. Installment sales receivables comes through from the Cape Town Community Housing, what they have, and then usually it's about for 5 years, and then it gets sold on, hence the reduction there. Investment property. On the NHFC side, we have one investment property, and you would have seen the growth, which is mainly as a result of valuation. And there are some investment properties for Cape Town Community Housing, which resulted from the cancellation of contracts and management making a decision to classify it as an investment property. The other non-current assets, which is the 12 million, property developed for sale also comes through significantly from Cape Town Community Housing, which is the projects that they're dealing with until it's developed and sold on. On our equity, only grown by 3%. Non-current liabilities is mainly funds under portfolio that we manage, and then current liabilities relates to on Cape Town Community Housing, the exposure to DIG mainly. a summary of an income statement. Again, our key income components are the interest on our advances. Again, we've included the company and the group for the reason that when the budget was done, the budget for Cape Town Group, due to the timing of the acquisition, was not included. So we've compared the budget of the company, which is the NHFC, and the group would include the Cape Town Community Housing, and just comparing it to the budget. In line with the business performance, because of low budgeted disbursements, the interest on advances follows that pattern. The interest on investments is more or less in line with what we budgeted for. The sale of houses, as indicated previously, relates to CTCHC. And the sale of houses, that line should be read in conjunction with the cost of sales, which is below the line of the 60 million. Other income relates mainly to rental income, as there is a note following explaining some of the other income that's included in there. Impairments, as indicated, was significantly ahead of budget, and there is a slide dealing with impairments specifically. Of note is the operating expenses that was contained below 34% below budget for the year, and our operating profit before tax, 75 million. Share of loss of an associate, we own one of our strategic partners in the previous slide is HIP, and we have a 25% share in HIP, and that constitutes the loss today. The intention is that within the next year, HIP will become operational and the relative income will come through. Interest paid is mainly the loan on for DIF on the subsidiary. So if you look at our profit before tax, it was 73 million. If you look at the company, again, significantly below budget, and the variances are explained in the next slide. Factors that impacted our profit before tax, resulting it to be 46% below the budget. Again, the business was slower below budgeted disbursement. Significantly lower interest rate environment, as well as impairments. Operating expenses below budget by 24%, mainly as a result of under-expenditure in marketing, computer, and outsourced services. Included in other income is the fair value gain on the investment property. We were successful in a tax refund that was charged previously by the receiver that came through during the current year, as well as one of the advances books that were settled in full, which contributed to other income. Impairments to mention that the difficult operating environment that we experienced also impacted on our clients. What is of note that of the impairments that we raised during the year, three clients contributed 65% of those impairments, where each experienced a unique set of risks, and we are involved with those clients looking at they are involved with restructuring, recapitalization, and turnaround, and we are involved in those discussions. Just showing the trend, again, following the trend of the year, profit before tax is lower for the current year. Related to that is the cost-to-income ratio, which is significantly higher, leading to the lower return on equity, and because of the level of impairments also raising the level from where it was historically about 5-6 to above about 9% for the current year.
Madam Chair, here we're reflecting the footprint of NHFC's target market. Now, as one can see, those red dots actually are demonstrating NHFC's footprint in various provinces. I think one can appreciate that as we stand, it's Gauteng, KZN, and Western Cape, Eastern Cape, and there are pockets of impact in Northern Cape, Northwest, and in the Free State. But I think this will also improve as we increase our business. But this is as we speak in the financial year under review. Corporate governance, I think that we have aligned to King 3 and also to the New Companies Act in preparation to align to that. And I think in terms of PFMA, we're still consistent. I think this is just the organogram showing the governance structure of the corporation. Madam Chair, I'd like just to conclude by saying to the Portfolio Committee that we had a strategic trust for the corporation early in the year, and out of that we redefined the area of focus of the corporation's business, and in view of that the four main thrusts are the ones that we've highlighted: expanding the housing finance activities, which is broader than just an HFC in that regard, but also to make sure that in all our dealings we enhance private sector contribution. And I think one can actually mention the fact that one of the instruments that we will be putting on the table, will be coming back to the committee about, is the whole issue of using the usage of the 1 billion guarantee to enhance greater private sector contribution, especially the banks in the market that we serve, as part of the mortgage default credit insurance initiative that we have undertaken. But I think what is also key is the whole issue of mobilizing finance on a sustainable basis, which links back to the question I raised earlier. When we look at densification, rental housing, social housing, rental market has been working because NHS has been funding it, and which is really government money and subsidies. If you take that out of the equation, there won't be any market for rental, social rental housing in the country. And so that's why the whole issue of mobilizing finance on a sustainable basis for the human settlement space is a prerequisite, I think, for us to actually make sure that all our people are actually accommodated and given an option, those who cannot actually acquire property, but at least to be accommodated through a rental option. I think HDA has spoken around the issue of land and the fact that the acquisition of land that is in private ownership, it is a challenge because funding is also an issue in that regard. And in line with what they communicated to the committee earlier, to say public land is priority, therefore when private land comes into the equation, we looked at an opportunity to provide some of the funding. We don't think we have all the funding to provide for such ventures that HDA may embark upon. And as you might see in the picture, this was Emerald Sky, which is an event that happened just after the close of the financial year, where Emerald Sky was launched by the President, which is one of the social housing rental projects that we funded. But may I also be hastened to say, without subsidies, such a project would not be on the table. I think which comes back to say, if we're moving densification, then, Madam Chair, we need different models for funding on a sustainable basis, because that is an answer, but I think it presents its own challenges. And I'd like to, I think this is the last slide, and we'll be open for questions, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you need to correct something on the slide. Page 9. You mentioned that on bullet 3, you mentioned that in spite of operating conditions achieved, there was a funding impact, including leverage and 1.3 billion or million, but you quoted
1.3 billion.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Honorable Dane, Honorable Lawute, Honorable Bowman, Honorable Fickland. Thank you.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chief. I think I must right at the outset just say that, and I hope I'm speaking for all of us and not just myself, that we had a
slight disadvantage in that we got these documents early this week and we've been sitting every day. So I certainly haven't gone through it as thorough as I would have liked to have done. But, Chair, I've just got a few limited questions in that regard. First of all, I'm not quite sure. I know we've raised this thing about the Cape Town Housing Company before, and if I'm not mistaken, the City of Cape Town had shares in it and then sold it and NHFC bought them. What is your shareholding in that company at the moment? That's the one question. The other one is, I'm quite interested to know, you've got jobs created, 1,480. How do you measure these jobs? And are they, when you say jobs created, is it of a sustainable way, or is it during the construction period, or just some information there? Then you did touch on it, but if you can expand, because one of the problems that the HDA has in terms of private land and the funding thereof is that they just seem to not make any headway through Treasury. Now, you very specifically mentioned, and it's in your report somewhere, that you do fund the acquisition of land for housing purposes. HDA didn't mention your organization at all. It is there, not only in the presentation today, but in any of the interactions we've had with them as a source of funding. So are there negotiations, are there talks going on between the two organizations? Your impairments was relatively high. Now, I know that we're coming from a history of economic downturn, but it brings me then to your your risk assessment. And mentioning that, you've got something that I'd like you to explain for me on page 40 of the actual document, where you've got your strategic risk profile, and it just looks like a lot of those dots in the yellow areas, yellow blocks and the orange blocks. I mean, if I look at the description of these risks, you know, failure of turning CTCH into profitable standalone, exposure to interest, inability to mobilize sustainable, damage to NHFC's image, it would appear from this, if I'm reading it correctly, that your risk profile is actually very high in most of these areas that you describe, which could be, for me certainly, very worrisome. And then perhaps you can also say what you're doing to address those issues. Then a last one, Chairperson. I've gone through this very quickly, and I seem to get different figures for housing opportunities. You've got in your presentation there, you've got housing opportunities created 11,000. Somewhere in the document, you actually refer, and perhaps I'll find it when the other people are asking questions, but there's, I seem to think you've got, yes, page 13, you say housing opportunities created through direct and leveraged funding jumped to 33,000 compared to last year's 14,000. If you can just explain that once again. I presume it's for the current, this last financial year, and you're not talking about successive years. So I'm not getting a good picture of exactly how many housing opportunities has been created. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think my mind needs to be refreshed here. My belief is that the land that is owned by the chiefs in the rural areas are state-owned land. I don't know if I'm correct. So it seems as if these agencies are focusing mainly in urban areas. What about our professionals in the rural areas who want to be assisted financially to own houses of their own? Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, thank you for your presentation. I just have one thing that I would like you to perhaps say a little bit more about it. I'm in agreement with you. I don't think we can be sustainable with what we are doing. I would like to know, to understand what you mean by mobilizing finance on a sustainable basis in order to turn this around. Thanks.
Another
Thank you, Chairperson. I think mine is just a clarity. I need to get a clarity where there is rental stock and all that. Is there anything called rent to buy? Maybe you rent a house for 10 years and then you can be able to buy it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the actual document, on page 40, on bullet number 246, they talk about inefficient leadership. So what I want to find, what have they done to address that inefficient leadership?
Okay.
Responses
there, Mr. Mara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To begin with, the first question was on CTCHC. The city owned 50%, and we own 50% from inception. In late 2008, they relinquished their 50%. In fact, they sold it for nothing. And we felt, because we're still being owed a lot of money, and we took the approach, we rather take it over to ourselves, so we own 100% of CTCHC. And that's why earlier on I did indicate that we've revisited their business model, we've changed that, and the new proposition of how they will approach business will be different. So it's a wholly owned subsidiary, and that's why even in a financial we speak about company and group, yeah, because it's now part of NHFC. Jobs created. Lorenz, do you mind commenting?
Thank you. The jobs that are reported relate directly to the project side of the business. So at the point of application, we request all our applications. When they, for example, develop a project of about 150 units, as part of the application, we need to report and capture, as part of that project, how many people are employed on the project. It's a combination of both permanent and temporary jobs. The permanent will be that team which is, and normally the permanent jobs are much fewer because it would relate to the project manager and more on the administration side. Then the other jobs that we count, because in a normal project we would also have, you know, the main company really subcontracts a lot. So it's those components of subcontracting that are on the project and off the project. So it's a combination of both permanent and non-permanent. So the majority would definitely be the contractual aspect of the jobs. Thank you.
The third question, Madam Chair, was on ACA. I think the question was, never have they ever mentioned NHFC. But let me assure the committee that we are in conversation with ACA. Our initial conversation has been to look into their forecast into the next 2 to 3 years. And truly, they expected that the first priority in ACA will be state land, which meant they did not need any funding. That's why in 2009-2010, there was nothing actually from our side that related to them. But not only that, they also had an expectation from National Treasury that they'll be getting an allocation of about $2 billion to be able to complete that part of the assignment. So we said we'll come back to those discussions once we've gone through that, because I think the challenge of always being able to identify public land which is surrounded by private-owned land will bring the issue of funding to the table. So we said we'll look at that in time. In fact, if you look to the last thrust in the last slide, actually does speak about actually funding land, but it speaks about an agency. The only agency we're talking about is HDA. And so because that's an agency which government has set up to consolidate all land parcels, to make them available for affordable housing. And the impairments, I think they've been significantly high. And the CFO did indicate that 65% of those impairments actually are due to three clients. But Madam Chair, I must say as well, much as the market has been difficult, but more than 60% of those impairments are one client whose issue is not just economic. And that's where maybe we may put it before the committee that we need your help, in the sense that we analyzed our non-performing book as the NHFC. And 43% of that non-performing book is related to government-linked kind of programs. These are programs where we are funding an entity with agreement with the province to say the province will have to cede whatever payment they're making to the institution to the NHFC. Contractually, this is written in the contract. And on the basis of that, we get repaid to the money which was supposed to have gone to the developer in this case. But now the province, I must say in this case is Gauteng, reneged on that agreement because they kept on paying the client, and the client took the money and did other things instead of actually the money coming direct to us. But that's not the only instance. All we are raising to the committee is 43% of non-performing has got to do with either the province not honoring the letter of the agreement that we entered into with them, or where they promised that they will actually buy a certain portion that we wanted to sell up to the private sector. It never materialized after we took it out of liquidation. And so when one looks deeper into this, you see this is not really an economic issue. As I say, 60% of those impairments are due just to those kinds of challenges where we do need an assistance from the committee in making sure that agreements entered into, especially with other public entities or the province or local authority, are actually honored. And I think in our case, we're finding this difficult because I think going forward, the stance we will take coming back to risk, we will identify that as a high-risk area, that we cannot allocate money there where we cannot get it. And so that's really the challenge about the impairment. 60% of those is just with one client, and I think the only issue there was not keeping to the letter of the agreement as signed. And so I'm just putting it before the committee as a big contributor to the non-performing book or the impairment, the size of the impairment. Impact, yes, on the impact side, we do report on impact that comes directly from our funding. And thereafter, we also include, we add to that the impact that comes from the funds we've leveraged from other parties, and together they make up the total impact. So that's 36,600. It includes what we funded directly and what was funded by other parties. That's really the sum total of that impact. So the 33 is actually the total, the sum total of that. I think in the annual report on page, I think the last page before the financials actually does capture the sum total of all the impact and the disbursement and the funding that we've made for the financial year. Madam Chair, I don't have an answer about land that belongs to chiefs, whether state land, I don't have an answer. But I think the one that I can answer is mobilizing finance on a sustainable basis. Our approach on that score is to be able to use other sources of funding besides banks, and in this regard, we have approached multilateral agencies. Like, for an example here, we have signed one with AFD, and right now we are to conclude one with AIB, which is funding that we mix with our own funding so that we make it affordable and actually sustainable. Now, we're looking for other funders who have developmental kind of mandates like ourselves, and try and use their funding and blend those with our funding and use that to be able to fund not only just NHFC but to make it available for other projects that are in the target market that we are serving. I think
these acronyms, AFD, EIB, I don't think.
AFD is French Development Bank Agency, and then EIB is European Investment Bank. Sorry, Madam Chair, we'll explain them before we put them. Thank you.
Honorable Richard. Oh, sorry.
Rent to buy option. Let me say that as part of our solution option towards renter, we've also working with the province and with local authorities have implemented in certain instances rent to buy option. Some of our clients are funded on that basis for the first 4 to 5 years, where people are given an opportunity to rent, and as their economic situation improves, then they get to a position where either they decide if they want to buy or maybe they continue to rent. But there is an option like that. In fact, CTCHC does the business mostly like that, and some of our clients that we fund actually use rent to buy as an option. Thank you.
I think we've got a problem. What is the difference between CTHC and the social housing? Because I think, if my memory serves me well, social housing totally rejected the notion of rent to buy. So where does this come from now?
Thank you. The Cape Town Community Housing Company, yes, it specializes with a unique product, which is a rent-to-buy option. Actually, they call it an installment sale. Now, an installment sale simply means the day the beneficiary moves into the unit, he's handed over the unit, he signs that contract. Instead of that contract being a rental or a lease agreement, it is an agreement of ownership from day one. Now, the social housing model on the other side is a pure rental forever with no option of that beneficiary when they moved into the unit having ownership. There are clear guidelines on the different models. The social housing model is regulated, and that's how it operates. It was not meant to actually hand ownership. That stock will be owned in that entity, which normally should be a non-for-profit entity, because all the money that is generated must be reinvested in the maintenance and the upkeep of the property. So I hope I've clarified it, because the social housing would be purely regulated by the letter of the law. And then what Cape Town Community Housing is doing, or what NHSC tries to find, is alternative other forms that actually address the need of ownership, because at the heart of what people want is at the end of the day to have ownership of the unit. So the installment sale option does provide a form of ownership that happens normally after 4 to 5 years ownership is given. The subsidy quantum is also slightly different depending on whether it's social housing or it's an installment sale. Thank you.
To speak to the risk management question, and I want to almost link it to, there is a slide talking to our governance structure. NHSC, we have instituted an enterprise-wide risk management section, which is headed up by an executive manager. But even before that, on an annual basis, the corporation would review, once they've confirmed their strategic plans, review the strategic risks in line with those plans and put action steps to deal with those. The executive risk management is supported by the government structure, and if you look at what's in the presentation, at management level, there's an entity liability committee, or previously a treasury risk management dealing with financial risk. There's a management credit committee dealing with all the credit-related issues. It's in the management committee's line, as well as an enterprise risk management committee. Although this is in its infant stages, it would be established within the next financial year. These management committees report through the executive committee currently to two board committees, the board credit and investment committee, which will look after the investment as well as the credit trust, and the audit and risk committee. During the last quarter, the board committees, in line with, they considered the recommendations of the New Companies Act, as well as King III, and various discussions were held, and they've actually recommended an adjusted structure to split audit and risk. So in, there would be a new board risk committee going forward. Coming back to particular reference to page 40, as mentioned, these highlights, as a company, we've identified as key risks and we've rated them. And the first four that was referred to is, for instance, failure of the NHSC to deliver on its expanded mandate. We see key that we are aligned to the our shareholder. And mitigation is obviously our business plan that gets approved by our shareholder on an annual basis together with the shareholders' compact, to make sure that what we agree, you know, our strategic objectives are in line with the view of our shareholder. The second one speaks to, inherent to our business, always credit risk. So, and as we've explained, over and above our credit committees, there are delegated approvals dealing with that. The third one, the failure, we've identified our relationship with CTCHC and the acquisition is quite significant. Hence, we've identified it as a key risk, the failure of turning it around into a profitable standalone business. And the mitigation, as highlighted by the CEO, they've re-looked at the business model of the CTCHC and identified a new business model which would be proposed through the various governance structures of the company. And the fourth one deals to the financial risk, maybe interest liquidity and counterparty risk, which are dealt with through both credit as well as treasury policies, and they would report into the management committees, the management credit committee, as well as the assets and liability, or previously treasury financial risk management committee.
Because it's not my, it's not a follow-up question from my side. I wanted just to raise some of the issues, and I think it's just a broader issue that I would love the team to assist me, and then bearing in mind that anyway you established 1996, surely you started working 2 years down the line, with your 12 years of experience. And then because the point that I want to take in your vision and your mission, firstly, your mandate was to ensure that you broaden the and deepening the access to affordable housing finance. And surely 12 years down the line, you must be assisting us. I don't know anyway, since 1998, 2 years really, even a leeway of 2 years, starting to, since that time, what would be the total number of your contribution in the ensuring that we defeat the very stubborn legacy of the homelessness? Because we are set up precisely because the banks were not interested to deal with some portion of our society. Surely the government was not just excited to set you up, there was a specific task why you were set up. And then I think because we must measure whether it is still a relevant structure to address the problem by the impact that we are making to address the whole issue of the middle income, low and middle income household, then how are you different from the existing commercial banks? Because the reason why you are developing that institution was supposed to be dealing this thing, I think, differently from how the banks are doing things. And then in my view, that is important for us as a community, just to get that sense that you are on track to deliver on your mandate. And then you are not the area also that you want to be a leader in development finance. Also, you want to provide innovative, affordable housing finance solutions. I think this is amended. I think 12 years down the line, surely, unlike the agents that developed the HDA one, because it's very new, would be difficult for me to pose that question. But for you, a decade experience, surely you must be assisting us now to arrive at a correct solution to resolve the question of housing backlog in the country. And also, what has been your experience over the last 12 years? Because if it is correct to say, again, Gomez, with the point that I'm raising, I wouldn't really care about how many people you employed in terms of your staffing. It's not my problem about operational matters. I think the problem of a political leadership always is about the impact that you are making. Because when we set you up, we have given you a mandate to do something to assist us to resolve a certain problem. And then defeating then this stubborn legacy of the homelessness, I think was your mandate. And then I'm not finding out, of course, I was not part of the committee for many years, and therefore I think the leadership that has been there for many years, I think they will know better than myself. But just for me, also, when I leave the meeting, I must be sure that the structure is still relevant, because there's no structure that is set up for 20 years anyway that cannot be reviewed, whether it's still relevant or not, in attaining what you wanted to attain. I think we are relevant structure just to assist me to understand that, and I take the risk that are there on page 40, the issues that I think the CFO is raising, I think that is fine. But in terms of your broader mandate, are you on track? Taking out all the recession and up and down, because you are not an FNB, of course, you are not also standard bank. We are set up, in fact, to mitigate that problem. And therefore, I think we should be able to have a sense whether the structure 12 years down the line is assisting us to address what you wanted to address. Or you have also just become part of the bigger institutions. Anyway. And because I don't know also how many people will know the National Housing Finance and then cooperation. I'm not sure really how many middle to low-income people know the existence of the trust in terms of communities, really. And then surely people will know about the existence of FNB and that structure, but I'm not sure how much really the structure is there on the ground in order for us to assist to address the written form. I don't know it myself, really. I know it because I'm here. And I guess that there will be some people who know anyway somewhere, but I don't have a plan. And then 12 years down the line, whether the agents set up by government in 1996 has been able really to spread, and then I don't want to say prosper, but just to spread something that is exciting to the people who really have been struggling, turned back by the bank because of the collateral and among the other, and also the real people who wanted assistance all along, because I think that was, to me, the real purpose why the structure was set up, was to assist us to deal with this problem and dilemma of people who can't access this from the commercial institution. Surely if the commercial institution were very open by that time, there was no need for you because they were going to, but it was precisely because of that risk. To me, I think that we must measure whether you are assisting us to achieve that what you wanted to achieve. Because then that will assist us. Where do we change things ourselves as a team? And how do we assist you? And then to ensure that we attain what we are supposed to do in terms of your mandate and also your vision. And that's the thing that to me would have been interested to hear from the leadership. What is your assessment, general assessment? And then, of course, I was saying that maybe sometime to come will assist us to know, since 1996 to 2010, how many units really, or how many households we have assisted to have access to low and middle income? Because the actual numbers assist us really to know whether we'll be able to make a dent in the real issue that we're raising before. And I think to me that would be really much more important for the political leadership. Because based on your information, we'll be able to say whether we should change the mandate
or whether we should do other things to ensure that we achieve that. That was the contestation. I think that's the point that I wanted us to comment on.
Okay. Thank you. Chairperson, thank you. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm new in this committee. Chairperson, I want to understand this. Is this NHFC established to focus mainly on urban areas or what? If not, if it's a national, as the name says, then how is it assisting our people in the rural areas who are professionals, who are who belong to the middle and low income, and who also want to own houses of their own? That is my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think let me just briefly address the issue of impact, especially impact from creation to where we're at today. Madam Chair, let me say that development impact can be substantiated using various indicators. And largely because we're financing institution, we actually highlight the amount of money that we're able to disperse in the market that we have set. But by no means that actually speaks the whole truth, because at the end of the day, is what is that translated into? I think that's really the question that is being asked, based on the mandate, that imperative that we're given. Let me say that since 1998, we were the first institution to finance social housing. In fact, Social Housing Foundation was formed in 1997. And part of our mandate prescription was that we should begin to stimulate mechanisms whereby we can start financing for institutions that will accommodate owners, that will accommodate housing solutions other than ownership. Because at the time, the assumption was that banks were doing mortgage, and therefore we needed other forms of being able to house people. And therefore, government set up the Social Housing Foundation to provide capacitation or capacity building in this segment of the market. But there was only a single funder for social housing. In fact, I can actually lay claim to say, had it not been of NHFC, social housing would not be where it's at today. Not only in terms of what social housing has done historically, from 1998 to 2002, we were the only institution financing social housing in the country. And therefore, private sector institutions looked into this sector and realized that after 2002, they began to gain confidence to say, if NHFC has been able to do this on a viable basis, then let's partner with it. First bank to partner was FNB. And today, 2010, there are a number of institutions that are playing in that segment of the market. But we catalyze the market, and as I said, Social Housing Foundation, social housing sector became what it is because of our intervention. But that's money terms. But can I also say, the institutions themselves, because for you to be able to deliver on a national basis, you need institutions to be placed in various provinces across the country. And I would say today you're talking about more than 50 social housing institutions, which have been capacitated either by Social Housing Foundation or they were formed differently. The fact of the matter is they all receive their initial funding, partly capacity building funding from NHFC and funding for the project that they actually undertook. So to that extent, we provided capacity in the market so that we can broaden access. So if one were to look at it developmental-wise, It's not just about the money, it's also about the access. People have got somewhere they could go to. They could go to Emeraldsky, which is in Eastern Cape. They could go to Soko, which is in Western Cape. They could go to Own Heaven, which is in Durban. So in so doing, we provide a mechanism through which government is able to deliver. So that's the contribution that you've made. But not only is it the social housing sector, but the whole incremental housing sector as well. When we started, our mandate said there are institutions in place, all they needed was funding, and funding the segment of the market that was not serviced by the banks. That's what the assumption was in 1996. Came 1997, 98, we realized that there were no institutions that were actually doing alternative funding except the banks. And we were, together with Ralph, and I think, may I remind the committee, Rural Housing Loan Fund used to be part of NHFC until 2001. So from 1996, when they were set up, to 2001, we set up other retail intermediaries. Now, talking about rural, to provide funding even for people who could not afford immediately to buy their houses, but making sure that their housing finance needs are met, we helped set up those institutions and funded projects that they were involved in using those institutions. So to that extent, we have broadened the access, because the issue is about access, the issue is about affordability. So our presence has brought in that which was not there. I think the banks, had they been left on their own, would not be here. But also in 2002, we realized that the banks were not working so hard in this segment of the market. We engaged the banks. Actually, we, in 1999, just as an example, we set up a company called Gateway Home Loans, which was a wholly owned subsidiary of NHFC. The reason we set up that company was to go and test the banks and say to the banks, go and raise loans in this segment of the market. We will buy those loans. It's not your risk, it's our risk. And then we'll make sure that those people actually get funding on a sustainable basis. What happened that was in 1999, it was a pilot for 2 years after 2001 March. The pilot, when we undertook it, we went to all the bank CEOs, we met with them, they said, oh, we support government, we'll do everything government says we should do, especially if you are taking the risk. At the end of the pilot, instead of having 20,000 people with new houses, we only had 2,000. Not even when we said to the banks, we are taking the risk, they did not come. And that is why we said to the minister at the time, we think we need CRA. We need some legislative framework to force the banks to come and lend. And that's why government at some point actually raised the issue of community reinvestment bill to say, maybe we need to force the banks to begin to lend in this segment of the market. The banks, 2003, came back and said, no, here's financial sector charter. We volunteer, minister, leave us alone. Give us a period. Let's see what will happen. The charter ended in end of December 2008. Now, if you go back and say, let the charter intervene, they say $42 billion was dispersed. What has happened to the backlog? It is the most remain where it was. Which actually says now we now have to come up with new mechanisms to bring the banks back to make sure that they actually play in this market. And that's why, Madam Chair, NHFC has been working hard since last year to this year to the launch of a mortgage credit default insurance instrument, which is linked to the 1 billion rand guarantee, which attempts to say to the banks, part of the risk that you're going to take, we're going to mitigate it, but we want you to actually intervene in this segment of the market. And I must confess, Madam Chair, that the backlog can only be met when you do scale kinds of activities. Scale does not belong to NHFC, Nature, Ralph. We don't have the capacity. The capacity lies with the bank. They've got branch infrastructure throughout the whole country. They've got systems that are robust. The challenge for us is how can we get them to actually do that business and do it well? And I think that is the challenge that we're facing. We see the backlog every time we look at it. It remains where it is because I can report and say, oh, we made so many loans, so many of this, but you look at the backlog, you see the picture does not match. And I think the ultimate answer to the challenge we're facing is to really find ways and mechanisms to bring the bank large scale so that we can have, instead of having 30,000, we have 500,000 per year, as much as we did with RDP. Government did a good example when it set the goal in 1994. They said 5 years to 10 years, we want 1 million houses. They were delivering about 220 houses per year. Now, until that happens, in the affordable housing market, we'll be looking at this backlog all over again every year. So let me say, our challenge has not stopped. Our challenge still says until we do get scale, which means partnering with the banks, every other institution, funding, infrastructure systems, only then will we be able to deal with the backlog. And so that's really my sort of like response to our mandate imperative. And then the last question is about if NHS is national, what about rural? Indeed, we are national. I think the map I gave out there says we are in every part of the country. But we are aware that the Rural Housing Loan Fund is mainly focusing at the affordability levels that are lower. If there are mechanisms, in fact, this is now beginning to take place. In some of those rural areas, mining companies are coming in to actually develop business, which means people will be migrating to those places. There will be a need for more affordable housing financing taking place. Yes, there are professionals, there are teachers, which is why we're launching the guarantee scheme, which will be able to cater. It does not matter whether you're, wherever you are, if you fall within that income bracket, you should be able to have access. And so to that extent, we will continue to provide solution, housing finance solution options, even for people in rural areas in that target market. I think that's really the reach, that the extent to which we want to take our intervention. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Have you been interacting with the department in terms of the strategy of bringing back the banks? Because I think you have to interact with the department on that one. You have to work out a strategy, or you commission a study of how could you those people with the project. So how far have you interacted with the department in terms of that? And then the second one, are you, what support have you provided to the cooperatives as far as from 1996 from establishment? And then the last one is about the intervention. I think Ms. Ngomezu, we have to respond to that. The intervention of the department on the issue that was raised by the CEO on this client that is consistently funded by the Gauteng province, because you are responsible for dispersing funds to the provinces. Now, were you informed about this problem? Because I think you have to intervene to address that problem.
Madam Chair, I can assure you we are working with the department in terms of driving to make sure that the banks are engaged. And we are at advanced stages, and that's why even the talk about the 1 billion, the mortgage credit insurance, we are doing it within a team that is in the department. And so we're working very closely in providing that solution option. As for cooperatives, Madam Chair, I'm wearing two hats here, because on one hand, I was just the past chairperson of Social Housing Foundation. And so I know that on one hand, the whole issue of cooperative movement has been a challenge in itself, especially in housing. The models that we have seen, like in the Scandinavian countries, they do work for housing, but for here, cooperatives have been successful in agriculture, I think, in the main. I think for social housing or for housing purposes, we have not enjoyed that kind of success. And I think to that extent, I know SHF came to a point of you know, trying to promote this as an option. I think it is still an option. Question, has NHFC funded cooperatives? Yes, it has. In the inner city of Johannesburg, we have funded cooperatives, about four of those. But I'm also quick to say to Madam Chair that we are currently liquidating two of those. One of them has come back and has renegotiated, and things are going well, and we think we'll promote, because cooperatives is about sort of like ownership of a different kind, and we're working together with the client to try and resolve the issues. The other two were hijacked somehow. You know, sometimes you read about building being hijacked, but institution can be hijacked too. Now, they were hijacked, and we tried to resolve this for the last 2 years without any resolution. And so we took the legal course, and it looks like we are on the right on this one. And that's why I say, yes, we have funded cooperatives, but it is a challenging sector.
Unfortunately, for this portfolio committee, we encourage that both cooperatives must be promoted. It is on the high agenda of the ruling party. So you cannot just leave it as it is. You have to ensure that you promote this cooperative movement. And you cannot just relate to Netherlands. Sweden is successful. There's quite a lot of countries that have got successful housing cooperatives, and then you can bring it to South Africa, and then you shape it in terms of our situation. So we are not buying in. We won't buy in, even tomorrow. Tomorrow when you come and report to us, you must bring us a clear report that is on the where the report that is clear, that is you are promoting the housing cooperative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue of intervening in contractual issues for the department, we have done in the past, assisted NYCHA, for instance, assisted Servcon, where there have been some defaults on the part of a provincial department. We will assist NHFC if they approach us, because so far we have not yet been approached. Wherever we are approached, we intervene. I would maybe answer that way, because we are having a track record of having assisted other institutions. Now, if Ingana Ikali, Chairperson, Sizoizanjantina.
Very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. I think we have come to the end of our interaction with the NHSC. I think the issue that was raised by Honorable Richard is a real concern to the portfolio committee. I think we have to go back so that you can come and bring us a full report on this one, and then we engage, and then we have a way forward on it. That is very crucial to us. Okay, thank you very much, CEO.
Natural.
You need our intervention? We will come. We will come.
Oh, yeah.
You don't need it?
We don't
have it. You know, we don't want to ask
for it. We don't want to pay.
We
don't
want to
our housing department has got so many plants. Yeah, so then they see a good one. About finance, about
to review in our own policy. Because if we don't care about this, we won't remove this policy. We think the things are fine, but there are a lot of things that we must change ourselves to make it easy for you to do the work here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and also thank you to members of this committee for the opportunity to talk about our performance and specifically to share some of the issues that we are facing in the first two quarters of this year. Madam Chair, I've broken down the presentation to the committee in a few points. And some of the slides I'm just going to run through very quickly. The first slide really is a repetition, but I repeat it because it's important for the committee to realize that nurture is in a very high-risk business. And when we say high risk, it's purely because of the nature of the clients that we deal with, particularly contractors, developers that are not able to access money from banks. They do not have a long track record in the construction industry, and they don't have appropriate forms of collateral to provide. So it's a high-risk business, and we recognize it, and we deal with it as a development finance institution. And we'll point out later on in the presentation what are the implications of this tool as an organization. One of the important things that I think Nurture has been fortunate is the fact that its mandate really talked to human settlements in many respects before the concept of human settlements being tabled in its formal form. And what I mean by that, Nurture in the past 5 or 6 years have been financing schools or bridge financing schools, community infrastructure, roads and so on. So we have been in that space, and it's useful to bring that now into contributing towards outcome 8. In terms of the year in perspective, it is important that we note that we've traded under extreme economic conditions. In general, we work with the private sector, we work with other development organizations and banks, and we felt the same pressures that the economy was feeling both internationally and locally because of the nature of our business and the financing partners that we have with the Soros Economic Development Foundation. So while the business has been slow, the contracts that we've signed was less by 14%, the houses built improved by 7%, the value of loans increased by 26%. So it's been a mixed level of performance, and I think we are quite pleased that given these difficult circumstances, we were still able to trade. Infrastructure projects completed up 71%, and I think that's a good level of performance. We were also able to mobilize private sector funding to the tune of 135 million. However, it has come at high cost. It has not been cheap. And then I also want to highlight to the committee, there's been also persistent non-payment from government departments. Now, and our operations officer will talk to this. 90% of the projects that we bridge finance, the employer is government, because these are either subsidy projects or infrastructure projects that are produced through government departments. And what we're seeing, and the trend is increasing, that late payments, delayed payments are causing significant problems in the operational environment for us as an organization. We also want to highlight in the year's perspective that we did require recapitalization, and we did put through a request to the National Department of Human Settlements. However, that did not materialize, but we continue with the proposals for further capitalization. We did report previously to the committee in terms of our geographical footprint and coverage, which we have now established in the 6 provinces. It's bedded down, it's working well, and this was an important risk mitigation tool that we've highlighted upfront in the business. If you want to be successful at construction, you've got to be at the point of construction. You can't be sitting in Sandton and managing a project in the Eastern Cape. You've got to be on site. You've got to be able to be proactive and provide contractors with the support. Also, we aligned ourselves with the 2 intermediaries, and we indicated that we were purchasing a 30% shareholding in both Tusk and Siva. That's been completed and now finalized. I think in the year, we are also happy to announce that the audit has been clean, and there's been a high level of compliance. We want to indicate to the portfolio committee, unlike the other institutions that I've presented, Nurture is a bit of a hybrid DFI. It has a private sector component in terms of the shareholder, and it has government. So the levels of compliance are extremely high. Chair, to share with you some of the development performances, and we compare that with 2008-2009, you can see that the actuals in respect of approved loans is slightly lower, but the actual in terms of completed houses is higher. And also to look at the 2010, although we at that time projected much higher levels of approved houses in the vacant loans and completed houses. We want to indicate to this committee that there's been a significant downturn in the volume of transactions that we've been seeing in the last two quarters. It's been a poor performing environment. In terms of loan and project values, we also see a slight increase there in terms of the project value. Again, you see a very high leverage ratio coming into play. In terms of completed houses and sites, affordable houses and sites, 2,976, subsidy housing, 14,548, and service subsidy sites, 1,648. So that brings us to a total of 19,000 and also a fair amount of infrastructure and community facilities projects were taken into the project pipeline. Again, this is a breakdown of the number of houses, sites in approved loans, and you can see the number fairly close to the budget. In terms of our geographical area of operation, predominantly you see high frequency of projects in KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, and Gauteng. Now, again, although we are trying to market and trying to have a presence across the country, a lot of these projects are procured by provincial and local government. So we don't have control in terms of the volumes coming. But we do have good interactions with provinces and local government to say that we are willing to partner and to work with you in respect of small contractors. So this is a picture that I think has improved over a number of years. You can see the Northern Cape coming into the picture, Northwest, Limpopo, and so on. Value of loans financed in rand millions. Now, again, Nurture as an organization has a relatively small equity capital. So in respect of 554 million that we have put out in terms of loans, we have managed to finance projects worth 3 million. 3 billion. In terms of the annual empowerment statistics, and this is an area that I want to spend a little time talking to the numbers because it relates to the risk profile of the organization. You can see that the number of contractors have increased, so we're seeing more smaller projects. The number of first-time applications moving from 59 to 70. So we are taking more inexperienced contractors into the pipeline and we're supporting them. We're seeing a slight or a good increase in female-owned enterprise. This was one of the questions raised in the previous meeting. And although we see the increase, it's encouraging and a lot more work needs to be done there as well. And then we see we have taken a slight drop in terms of emerging contractors versus established contractors. Chair, I'd just like to ask our CFO to take us through the financial picture.
Thank you, Chair. I will just present this abridged financial performance. The income from operation, it has increased from, it has decreased from 49 million to 43 million, a decrease of 12%. And the administration expenses have increased by 11%. And this year we had a major surprise in terms of net surplus or deficit for the year. For the year, we are reporting a deficit of about 18.8 million, which is really, it was not expected, but the economic situation has forced us to operate in that way. You will also notice that there was a significant increase on our provision for losses, an increase of about 39%. And the loans for construction projects, there was a slight increase there of about 0.4%. And the bank loans to finance projects, there was an increase there because Nature was running out of own funds. They were to get to use more of borrowed funds than our own funds. supply chain is very important to us, in the sense that it tells us how much we could still trade in the industry. And I want to highlight as well that even though we might be seeing that nature has a net capacity of about 95 million, the challenge that we have is that the funds are restricted to certain programs. We cannot move certain funds from one program to the other. For an example, the money that is available for subsidy emerging of 8.7, we cannot use in anything else other than that program. And really, things are getting worse for us. We are running out of our own funds, and on the established established subsidy and affordable program, we saw really a major decrease there, because we used to have enough funds to finance projects there, but now we don't have any. We have to use natural money now to finance projects. And the emerging infrastructure, at the end of the financial year, we didn't have any funds available, in which case, therefore, NATO had to top up funds under that program. But again, fortunately, we have now a deal with Future Growth, which is going to at least give us access to their funds, even though they are not coming at a cheap interest rate. Jay, just the key highlight on really why the results were that bad. We have observed that there's been a failure by employers to allocate tenders. And really, as Morgan has indicated, if the tenders are not allocated, contractors won't come to NATURE to apply for loans. And we also experienced late payments by employers, especially the state-owned organs. And we are trying to put pressure as far as we can, and with the assistance of National Department of Human Settlements, we are putting pressure on those employers to pay us on time. We also have observed that, especially on the infrastructure, that some of the funds could only be repaid to contractors when the project has been completed fully. And to finalize the final account takes longer than expected. And as such, we end up having to provide for the funds as not recoverable. We also have observed as well that most of the employers had budgetary challenges, and as such, they couldn't pay the contractors on time. And again, the general state of the economy was bad, and that had an impact on NATURE's performance. And we also trying to apply or negotiate loan facilities with private funders, but unfortunately, those funds are not available at a cheap rate, and such that has an effect on our performance. And as I indicated earlier on, our own funds really continue to decrease. And but yeah, we hope that maybe in the next financial year we might be allocated something. Chair, those are the key issues I want to talk
about. We continue to align with outcome 8. We see from a mandate, a point of view of the vision, NATO is very closely aligned. However, we are working with the National Department very closely to develop programs that would support that outcome. We seriously need to raise additional funding from the state. And the reason we emphasize the state is because we've reached the threshold of how much we can use our current capital to leverage private sector money. So, you know, we can't continue to borrow at high cost from the private sector, but then we just pass on that close cost to the contractor, which I think defeats the purpose of the development objective that we're trying to pursue. We've raised earlier, we have to deal with the non-payment from particularly government departments. We have to make that process more efficient, because ultimately it's not only nurture that has high provisions. You're now dealing with small contractors that go out of business in 2 or 3 months' time. So we need to deal with that. I think we want to leverage this regional footprint that we have. And we're looking to working with the other institutions. We have capacity in the 6 provinces currently, and we want to use this and leverage this capacity to its full extent possible. We're also suggesting that to bring in new contractors and make them sustainable, we have to have a technical assistance window to support it. We're looking at how we support the youth, women, and other contractors into this business. We're not saying that everybody can become a contractor, but we want to make sure that the activity of contracting can become a sustainable one, and contractors on an ongoing basis can be able to procure work so that they become sustainable. What we're seeing as a trend is that contractors are able to procure work in year one. There's a gap in year two, procure work in year three. Those gaps create sustainability issues for the contractor, and we need to deal with that. And then lastly, in conclusion, Chair, I think given its smallness in terms of its financial capacity, so far Nurture has produced projects since inception to the value of 10 billion rand. So we haven't financed all this, but we used the capital to leverage, meaning that we recycled it to complete many projects. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Mwongezo, now I'm just going to refer to you. You know, I must be honest, Nurture is close to my heart because of the, I think the issue of developing the capacity of the nation contractors, it's a crucial matter that we need to be serious about it. We have been complaining about this shoddy works we are experiencing. They understand the role that is played by NHBR. You remember last time, they even asked a question. Why do we have these capacity building programs being scattered? Why can't they be put under one institution? For instance, I think Nurture is doing very well because NHBRC's role is clear, is to oversee the quality assurance. So I think as the department, because you are busy with the restructuring and the funding models within the department, I think you have to think about this. Really, they, to me, they have been trying so hard. I think it's high time that the department intervenes into this issue of nature. So I'm giving you a homework. Honorable members, can we, Honorable Stole, Mashishi, Spain, Bome.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, my question is directed to department, because according to the report, Nature says they have required some capital from the department. So what I want to find out, what help did the department have provided to Nature to that regard? And another thing, Chairperson, I think if Nature says they use their own fund to fund the project, I want to find out actually from the department. Because they have to help the nature to do their do their own work. And another chair on page. On page. Oh, there is no page here. They talk about this financial help or financial risk. No, I'll come back to check because I have to check. Oh, the annual employment status. There is nothing that has been said about disabled people. There is nothing that has been said by her. Yes. There was nothing that has been said about childhood families and about the disabled people who because they talk about family owned, they talk about male owned, but there's nothing about on sort of focus.
I think yeah, they are referring to the contractors. So you need in Africa to know about him, the participation of the disabled person.
Yes.
You want that to be reported on. All right. Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry. Even though you said nature is in your heart, and then I just want to find out on the annual employment status. Yes, I know that they are struggling, but I see the percentage of women is low. But I heard the presenter saying that they are still going to empower more women. I think they need to consider it and then taking care of it. And then again, on the breakdown of reasons for poor performance. What was the reason for the failure of the employers to allocate tenders? Did they find out what was the problem, especially on this on the breakdown of the reasons here? Thank you, Jefferson.
Thank you, Chair. I think umilileliwelela. So Zamon Vanel. Chairperson, mine is just a point of clarity on the service sites. Where are these service sites? In which province are they? And then the other questions are along the 250 million when was requested. What was the explanation that why you were not given that money? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm a little bit concerned. You, I think, correctly opened up your presentation by indicating the high-risk market, excuse me, that you're working in, and it's not the first time you've brought this to our attention. You also, I get the impression of the entities that come before us that you tend to get your money at it costs you a lot more to access money than anybody else for some reason or another. I'm worried that will we actually ever go to concern if this, you're looking at basically recapitalizing the organization. If that doesn't happen, then we don't ever go in concern. Now, having said that, I also want to touch on what the Chairperson said, because I made a note here. I'm very aware that NHBRC, and we'll see it later in the week, does have a budget for particularly supporting and training of emerging contractors. And I'm concerned equally, like the Chairperson has indicated, that we've got various organizations that's repeating the same type of service, which means we've got budgets out there that we can consolidate and probably do a better job. So it's something that I want to raise as well. But just talking, and I've had the same constraint with your report that I've had with the previous one. You mentioned something about purchasing 30% holding in. I didn't get the tail end of what company or what. Now, I need to know which one it is and why. Then your admin costs have increased by, I think, 11%, and yet your turnover has dropped dramatically now. It shouldn't really go into two different directions, two opposites. So what has been the cause of that? Your provision of bed debt has gone up dramatically as well, I think from last year. If I'm not mistaken, it's 40% now. Can you tell me, in fact, I think you've actually underestimated it compared to the end result. Then, having just said two other entities before us, I think your board of directors are much larger than both the other two entities. Now, why is that when your sort of turnover is so small relative to, well, I won't say relative to HDA, it just kicked off. why do you have so many members on your board? We all have to be remunerated. And I also noticed that there are two members, non-executive members, where specifically it's been indicated that they are not independent. Now, obviously, there is of some concern as well. If they're not independent, they shouldn't even be on the board, as far as I'm concerned. Then your income, is it purely from interest? Because I take it, and I think all of us have this problem that when entities like Nurture and even NHFC and so on appear before us, and you're basically lending money to you provide bridging finance. So I would imagine your only income is based on the payment of that with the interest. You've got no other form of income, really. Is that correct? Chair, that's... Yeah, just the other thing. A large portion of your bridging finance goes to, because you indicated 90% of your contracts are government-related. So I would imagine that you're providing the bridging finance to somebody that have gotten a contract from, and let's stick to subsidized housing, which is what we're interested in. So you then, a developer, emerging contractor, got a contract from government to subsidized housing, you provide the bridging finance, and at the end of hopefully at the end of the period, you then, or as the development goes along, you get your payments. Unlike with NHFC, where they're in a situation where the developer was paid directly and they didn't get any payment. Thanks. Thank you, Sean.
So you haven't, I'm pretty much covered, but I think, let me just hone in a little bit more specifically. I think we must not take this thing about the non-payment by government departments lightly. And I think it seems to me we've actually got a serious problem here. And I think my question to you, and I'm supporting now everything else that has been said here, and this is of great concern to me. And again, because of the knock-on effect, it's not just the big boys up there that are going, you know. It's little guys that are trying to put a loaf of bread on the table for little kids waiting at home, you know. And if you break it down like that, you know, we're comfortable. It's okay. But I think those of us in the driving seats, we've actually got to be very careful about this and make sure that things happen. And my question to you would be this. If 90%, you know, of your business is government related, what is the size of what is owing to you by these government departments?
Thank you, Chairperson. When talking small contractors that you are financing, small, medium, and what contractors, when talking small, which grades are we referring to? Because we know that contractors are rated according to their grades. And if the lowest grade, then how many emerging contractors did you finance, especially in the rural areas? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I think the recapitalization question, we'll come back to that because I think the department is also here to respond to that. On the question of the empowerment statistics, we would like to improve and give you additional information on disabled people, youth, and so on. But one of the important considerations there is that we have no control in the adjudication and in the awarding of tenders. So to try and deal with that, we are now working with the provinces and we've worked with national to say if the conditional grant and a percentage of the conditional grant can be made available for these activities. And there's an ongoing discussion around that. Specifically on the issue of women, we're now working with the national department on a national small contractor program. And we want to use this program as an opportunity to induct contractors into a program and we want to have a defined set of rules and a program through which we take them from emerging to emerged, which is not going to be an easy issue, because one of the things that we face is that we need to feed the process with more work on a regular and an annual basis. So there's going to be a lot of discussions between ourselves and the provinces that allocate projects. So while we cannot directly influence the situation, we are working behind the scenes to try and incentivize and provide programs that can be accessed by these groups. The question around poor performance and the failure of employers to allocate tenders, my assessment of what's happening in the provinces recently is that the shift from the programs of housing to human settlements may be partly to be blamed for this, because it means that many of the projects that have been conceived previously will now need to be relooked at and prioritized. That's the one area that we've experienced some changes. The second is there's an ongoing lack of budgets within the department. So it's either an underspending on projects from previous years and the management of that, which makes it difficult for tenders that are in the pipeline to come through. We were on service sites. Would you like to take that one?
Thanks, Chair. Perhaps on service sites, the service sites that we finance, which has been a slow portfolio in the portfolio of projects that we finance. The project sites that are sitting on our portfolio remaining sit in KZN and in Gauteng. But for definite areas, we can come back to the committee to say where that project is located, if that is, that would be required. But you would see that it's remaining a smaller portfolio, particularly on the subsidy housing side. But on the affordable housing side, as we finance both the development of affordable housing sites and continue to finance the houses, bulk of our affordable housing, though it is growing to other provinces, we've been historically concentrated in Gauteng. We've got a good portfolio of projects in KZN as well under affordable housing. Okay. So the couple of other projects, issues that were raised around the pricing of capital, just to underscore that, I think the point that we are making, as NESHA, we try and raise funds from partners in the private sector. And hopefully for those contractors, you want to be able to provide bridging finance that can come within the cash flows of the project, that is, that can be afforded. And in the last 2 years, you've seen a general escalation in the price of funds that we can access in the market. And I don't think that it solely affects nature. But because we are takers of the price and we pass on to the contractor, there's no way the contractors have to face a rising cost of finance for them to implement their projects, which when you start to look at the rising cost of financing, paired together with the slow payments that are coming from employers, the accumulation of interest that they have to face, and therefore the erosion of the viability of the project becomes a serious problem. And that leads directly to how you see the rise in provisions for losses, because these contractors that we finance, if the system of flow of payment does not work, they do not have any other source of resources from which they can pay their loan. Because our loan is advanced on the strength of the project, that is the viability, but perhaps also on the assumption that the system will work. Even if it deviates, it does not deviate a lot from what is expected. We can tolerate if a payment that is expected in 30 days and it happens in 90 days. But if it goes far beyond that, then it becomes a problem. Then there was a question on the training.
like to just distinguish the type of work we do with the contractors, which does not which is not necessarily similar to what NHPRC does. For us, the support that we provide to contractors, it is the support, firstly, as a risk mitigation and improvement of operations of the contractor whilst that contractor is working with us. You will realize that we've got no other source of security from that contractor except that project performing. And therefore, the gaps in the entity that we finance, we have to plug them ourselves, that is from particularly financial administration and technical support to ensure that they complete that project and complete it efficiently. That is, efficiently would translate into a profit to the contractor as was projected. That's the area where the contractors benefit from capacity building. It does not necessarily replace the structured capacity building that NHPRC does with the contractors in various categories that they present the capacity building.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I should respond to the issue of capitalization of nature. I think honorable members should understand that nature is a joint venture between the Soros Foundation in America and the government of the Republic of South Africa. Now, that joint venture agreement was that for every dollar which George Soros invests in nature, there will be a matching rand which the government would also provide. Now, having given that, we must also understand that funding is no longer forthcoming from Soros because of financial conditions in America. In fact, Soros is now investing in other, you know, philanthropist ventures, which are outside housing. So this has, in a way, handicapped the refunding or recap of nature. The second thing I want to point out is that when we approached Treasury last year, giving Treasury our requests for funding and for recap, it was for the department, first of all. Then it was for institutions. We requested Treasury to capitalize HDA, to capitalize NHFC, to capitalize Rural Housing Loan Fund, to capitalize Nature. There were figures which were given to Treasury. Now, as you know, honorary members, that we are competing for funding from the fiscus. And as you know, that ESCOM was a priority last year. So we were denied funding for HDA, for NHFC, for Nature. Only Rolf was able to be recapped, I think, to the extent of 47 million. We were told that these are not priorities. We are still going to approach Treasury on behalf of these institutions with our requisition for the new MTF. We don't know what will be the answers, but we motivate, as we have done last year. Treasury decides, which, in fact, it's not Treasury. There's a committee consisting of cabinet ministers who decide who has to receive what of the national cake. So I think the problem around recap centers around that we are competing for what is there in the state coffers. We will still approach Treasury as we did previously.
Can I deal with the balance of the questions?
The question relating to the 30% shareholding relates to the two intermediaries that Nurture worked with. Essentially, Nurture had a head office structure, and it worked with Zebra and Tusk in the various regions that had the branch network. So we felt that it was an operational risk, and we wanted to have control over what these companies are able to do, manage the standards, manage the costs, and therefore we've decided that we would take up a 30% share for that. And that was approved via the BFMA status and was completed in this past financial year. In respect of the board of directors, the fact that Nurture is a hybrid development finance institution that has a private sector shareholder and a public sector shareholder, two of the directors are nominated from the SEDF, and therefore you find them in the annual report as not being independent. In terms of the process, I think Viwe explained the process in respect of lending. The methodology is quite clear and straightforward in the respect that public entities or public institutions will procure a project, Nurture will provide the bridging finance, and the contractual obligation is between Nurture and the contractor. However, the contract for the project is between the contractor and the employer, which in 90% of the cases is government, and that's where the breaches occur. In terms of the size of the size of the provisions has increased, and it relates purely to the payment problems. And I think if we resolve that, a lot of these payments can be recovered, because one of the risks that we manage is that we make sure that contractors complete the project. So outstanding monies against that project needs to be claimed back. Now, it's very difficult for a province that doesn't have the budget to pay the money. So something needs to give at that level. Then in terms of the grading, I know Viewer will comment on the grading of contractors. But certainly we have a presence in rural areas. We do finance, bridge finance schools in rural areas, rural roads, and so on. But the volumes of those transactions are quite low. Again, a lot of these projects are dependent on the employers putting out these tenders. Chair, Stephen?
As well on the going concern, we are comfortable at the moment that we do have enough capacity to continue operating as a going concern. That's why in our director's report, the directors are giving that assurance. Yes, we happen to have these funds from private investors, like for instance, we have still OPEC and FNB that are financing the emerging subsidy housing program. And we have signed now this deal with Future Growth for the infrastructure. At least then it makes the company to continue to have access to funding. And really we are also hoping that going forward, at least government will then inject more money into the company. Okay. There was an issue as well about what percentage or how this late payment is affecting business that is coming from government. Currently, or at the end of last month, we had about 135 million overdues, and about 50% of that was due to late payments by employer government department. And at the time, we had a load book of about 410 million rand. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, perhaps just one question that hasn't been answered was the reason for 16 board members. And then secondly, I have a problem because officials tend to come with double talk, as we saw earlier or heard earlier with Nurchan. And they've spoken to the department then said no, they approach them. Because I think it's the CFO, indicated to us now that they're not too concerned, that it is a going concern. And then at the end, he still lectures on that
provided government's going to come to the party. Now, my question was, if you are not recapitalized by government, will you still have a going concern? Which, to me, and I'm sorry, but with respect, I don't seem to get the feeling that you're looking at cost-cutting measures. You're in trouble, you need to cut costs somewhere, and I don't get that feeling that that's what you're doing. You just, you know, you're hoping, and with respect to the government as well, we do have other demands on Treasury, and we need to bear that in mind, so they may not necessarily get the money. So you need to, you of all people should have said, here's a rescue plan if we don't get the money. Because it's not just you, it's those other contractors that are depending on your assistance. My colleague here indicated, and it's the beneficiaries of that development if they can't do it, and so it goes down the ladder. So I am concerned that urgency doesn't seem to be there. We'll get the money, so we'll just carry on with business as usual.
Chair, the number of board members is really determined by the shareholders agreement between government and Soros Economic Development Foundation. What's happening is that there are charters now for SOEs. There will be an alignment to that, and possibly numbers may be reduced, but that's where it originates from. It is a high cost to carry, and I think we agree with that. I think the issue relating to going concern, while in the short term there may be no problems with the going concern matter, the way in which Nurture's balance sheet is structured is that it's sitting with a number of SPVs. Now, traditionally, we've used Nurture equity in those SPVs to leverage private sector money. We are saying now we're unable to do that further. And that's why we need to be recapitalized. So, therefore, it's not just having the equity in the business. It's how much more can we do. So, for example, if we now say that we want to support outcome 8, and the number bandit that we put on the table is to double our outputs, then certainly a capital injection is required. Yeah.
Chairperson, just to support the CEO, from where we are sitting as a department, capitalization was meant to expand the impact of their business outside. But they do have enough capacity currently to be carrying on with their normal business from day to day. So it's not a train smash, but capitalization will be a bonus for them to expand far more than they are currently doing. As I indicated, we depend mainly on Treasury to get the finance. We will be sitting with our colleagues again, debating, and hopefully we'll be able to extract, as you extract a tooth, out of Treasury some funding.
Okay. I think we have come to the end of our presentation for the morning session. We are going to break up for lunch, and then we'll come back at 2. Yeah, because I was going to go to the department, and next year, what is it?
Tomorrow.
Only the department. Oh. After the department, our visitors, the running parliamentarians at 5, are going to meet with them at the same day. Thank you very much.
Yes.
No, it's someone else.
Yeah, it's someone else.
It's probably going to be the DJ.